41, Thursday, October 20th.
Sure. We can go.
All right, so we're back into open session. We had a briefing from legal counsel, executive session. There was no action to be taken as a result of the executive session. We will go and see, are there any members of the general public who would like to address the board at this time? Is there anyone on the phone who would like to address the board at this time?
Don't believe we have anyone wishing to speak. No one has signed up for public comment, Vinia? Okay. So I think we can proceed. We'll come back.
Okay. So the next one, since we, is there anybody from the Citywide Advisory Board?
We'll do Lupe after we'll do the audit first.
Okay. The next item is the consent agenda. So we'll take up the approval of the board minutes from the September 15th.
Hello.
There's a motion made by Commissioner Carrington.
Second.
Second by Commissioner Apostello. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. To item number two, independent auditor's report for fiscal year ending March 31st, 2022.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're glad to be joined once again by our able auditors from Berman Hopkins. Laura Ann Frey is our lead audit partner. You all may have remembered Brian Nemeroff in previous years because of the work we did with Berman Hopkins in administration of the rent program. Brian went to spearhead that effort, and we thought it was important for independence that we had a new audit partner brought in to help make sure that we had all the rigor we want in our audits. And so Laura Ann has done an able job over the last 2 years being part of that, last year in a transitional way, working with Brian, and then this year as our audit partner. Sean Cedar's been known to all of us for a long time. How many years have you been? Four or five years now?
At least. Yeah.
as previously audit manager, now audit director, and we're lucky to have him. He really knows our process well, so we're glad to have Sean. In the interest of full disclosure, Commissioner Carrington and Commissioner Duncan Hall had an opportunity to join staff earlier to have a discussion, just an informal conversation about the audit. So they've had the benefit of about an additional hour's worth of insight. I just want to disclose that, but welcome your presentation and thanks for being here with the board.
Yes, thank you. So this will start hour two of the audit presentation. No, I'm just kidding. Everyone looks a little nervous.
Hour three.
I just wanted to reiterate a few things. This presentation, you know, we really do this presentation for you all. So please, if you have questions, you know, interrupt us. We want to make sure that we're answering all of your questions. We're going to go ahead and get started then in the essence of time. So a few reminders, the information that we're sharing with you is as of March 31st, 2022. So some of the numbers, you know, might look a little bit different than the more updated information that you're getting from Barbara and her teams. Our audit covers not only accounting, but it also covers compliance and controls. There's a litany of reporting standards that the audit and the financial statements have to be in accordance with, specifically because you receive government funds. Not only do you receive government funds, you receive a certain threshold of federal funds. And then because those federal funds are coming from HUD, all of those levels have their own required reporting and testing metrics. So I'll jump right into the most important part is the opinions. There's three levels of reports that we include in our financial statements. The first is just a standard auditing report. The second is a government auditing report, and that is really looking at the utilization of these funds because they are taxpayer dollars, making sure that the information, you know, that the transactions that the authority is involved in are not wasteful. They're not indicative of abuse, but they're reasonable and necessary for the agency as a whole. And then our last report that we include is a compliance report related to those major programs. And so I'm happy to report that all of the reports that we issued this year are what we would call unmodified reports. So this is a snapshot of the most important paragraphs in that initial auditor's report. And this is just showing that our opinion is stating that the information is presented fairly in all material respects, and it's all accurate. There was a slight change in the auditor's report this year. I did want to mention just geography, honestly. The actual opinion paragraph that we're looking at right here was on page 2 of the report. They moved it up, and now it's the very first paragraph. It's the most important paragraph of the report, so they put it right at the top so everyone could see it. There's also some additional required wording in the report that refers to going concern analysis. I wanted to call attention to that because people hear those words and they hear going concern and they get nervous. That is required wording. It's nothing additional. If there was a concern that we had, there would be additional paragraphs. This is the snapshots of the government auditing report, and in this report, we don't actually issue an opinion. What we do say is that we identify any deficiencies that we may have found. We did not find any, so we state that we did not find any deficiencies in your internal control and that our test of compliance disclosed no matters that needed to be reported. And this is the snapshot of the uniform guidance report. This is your compliance report related to your single audit. Again, same geography change. That opinion paragraph is now at the top of that report. And this report says that the authority complied in all material respects with the compliance requirements that were deemed to be direct and material. Your major program that we tested this year was the housing voucher cluster. So that includes the Section 8 program, it includes Mainstream, and it also included this year the emergency housing voucher program. And also in this report, again, we state if we had identified any deficiencies in internal control. We note that we did not identify any deficiencies in internal control as it relates to the compliance of those major programs. Okay, so your financial statements are currently at about 68 pages. That's a lot of information to look through. I always like to point people to a couple of key summarized areas. Management's discussion and analysis is at the front of your financial statement package. Sean is going to go over some of the information that's reported there, but that's a good executive summary, comparable information current year to prior year. Your schedule of expenditures of federal awards, we will talk about that as well. That lists all of your federal programs and the amount of funding that you received. And then the last one is your schedule of findings. And again, findings is just the title of that report. It does not mean that you actually have findings. It's just where you would look to find that information. And on the right-hand side is actually what that schedule looks like. And we like to call this the report card for the authority. It's a one snapshot, one page that you can go to that tells you all of the things I just mentioned are listed in the probably 12 pages or so of the reports. So your financial statement opinion is an unmodified opinion. We didn't identify any deficiencies. Your federal awards is an unmodified opinion. The major program was the housing voucher cluster. And then again, at the bottom, you know, we did not have any reportable findings in any of those areas. And also no findings in the prior year as well. There are some required communications that we have as auditors to make sure that we're reporting appropriate information to the board. A couple of items to make note of that are changes that are going to be implemented in the future. There's a few new accounting standards that are coming out. So there's a new lease accounting standard that will create some changes in some of the reporting for the authority. There's also a subscription-based software accounting standard that's coming out. And to summarize those, if you have any sort of operating lease or contractual agreement related to subscription-based software. Right now, that's not necessarily reported on your financial statements. It's just a disclosure in the footnotes. What the change will do is it will be adding an asset for the right to use those assets, and you'll also have a liability for those future payments. So you're going to add an asset and add a liability. They won't directly offset each other, but they'll be pretty close, so they shouldn't have a significant impact on your financial reporting metrics. One of the most important items that I want to communicate to the board. Oh, yes, sir.
Can you explain to me what the subscription-based software means? What does that mean? Does that mean we have using some sort of computer software and it to record stuff, or is it mandated by, I guess, the federal government accounting office?
Yes, sir.
Go into more detail.
Yes. So it is a new accounting standard. So this is for every governmental agency. This is a new accounting standard. And what that's addressing is for softwares that you are not necessarily purchasing and holding as an asset because you've purchased a software and now you've added this asset, you're paying a monthly fee or a yearly fee to have a subscription to use this asset. So that in and of itself is an asset for the authority. You've paid money to be able to utilize this software. So that's an asset that'll be being added to the financial statements, but you also have a liability. You also have a contract to make this payment for this software. And it is, there are analysis over the length of that subscription. So if it's short-term in nature, in most instances, there will be no change in how that's recognized. But if it's longer-term, if it's multiple years, we'll be adding an asset as well as the liability that you have.
And for clarity here, our biggest subscriptions are the RD and Elite.
I'm sorry?
For here, our biggest subscriptions would be the RD and Elite.
Yes.
I think I can add that is that YARD and ED, we both signed a kind of a contract. We purchased that as a fixed asset, We pay using the licensing, so we have the authority, we can use their system. But in addition to that, you're also going to see that we have to pay some kind of annual maintenance expenses. Mm-hmm. That means that it's not really for us to purchase the right to use the system, but it's the right, it's the some maintenance expense we pay them. That if we have a question, if we have bug, we have anything that we need them to help us to repair, to provide them some type of guidance, how to do maybe a training or something like that. So that's using that to, we do have that, but we do already capitalize that the one-time purchase. We do have that, we purchased, we spend the money, the large lump sum, then also in addition. So it's a little bit different from what she said, but that's what I'm saying is us. That's what we are paying right now. We pay two parts, capital and the operating expenses. So.
Mm-hmm. Does that address your question, sir?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's kind of weird. Yeah, I figured that, at least, if you have a subscription, so like you have a subscription to the Wall Street Journal.
Correct.
That is probably somewhere, and so it sounds like they have come out with a new way to record all these things. And
yes.
If your subscription to the Wall Street Journal is an annual deal, I guess you have to short in a different column.
Correct. Yeah. If it's short term in nature, then there's
what do they determine as a short term? Is it like a year?
Typically a year. Typically 12 months. Yeah.
Okay.
Unless, and this doesn't come into play as much, but unless there's if there's a related party nature, then you have to analyze that a little bit different because you might call it short term, but if it's a related party and you have full, and that's really for if you were leasing a building. If you were leasing a building from another related party, are you really going to cancel that lease after a year or are you just going to renew it annually?
Okay. I'm good.
Okay.
But it is an asset when you think about what Yardi and Elite do for us. I mean, they're these are large systems for which we pay hundreds of thousands of dollars each year. And they really do form, working in Keith's division, you know, a lot of the technology backbone that holds the agency. So it's a,
Which is why they refer to it as a right to use asset. So it's not the actual asset itself, but you have the ability to utilize, you've paid for or will pay for the ability to utilize that software or that asset. All right. There are some accounting estimates that are in your financial statements. These are nothing unusual to your agency. There's been no changes here. It's just something that we always want to point out to the board. You have some allowances.
Okay, keep going.
Okay. You have some allowances on your receivables, the estimated useful life for your fixed assets, as well as what you are determining is the current portion of your compensated absences. All of those are estimates based on historical knowledge, management's expertise. And the most important items that I wanted to communicate besides the actual opinions and results of the audit is that we did not have any disagreements with management. We did not have any difficulties during the audit process. And we also did not have any significant corrected or uncorrected misstatements that we found as a part of our audit that would be indicative of poor financial management, on part of the agency. I think that's really important to note because, as I mentioned, this information is 6 months old, and to, you know, have confidence and feel comfortable with the information that you're getting on a more regular basis from your team as board members, it's very important to know that you can utilize that information to make the management decisions that you all need to make. We did get a question earlier on whether our audit was remote or in person. It's hybrid, just for everyone's benefit. We do come on site to do some of our testing for about a week or two, but with access to the system and various different things, we are able to also do a lot of the audit in a remote environment. All right, I'm going to hand it over to Sean, and he's going to talk about the financial highlights.
Financial highlights from fiscal years 2021 compared to 2022. So data that was 6 months old compared to data that's 18 months old. Capital assets this year went up $24 million. That consists almost solely of ground lease land deals done in Austin Affordable. There were 6 closings done for 2022, and that comprises that entire number. Non-current liabilities, it's the same thing, went up $18 million, and that represents $24 million of those deferred ground leases associated with the land, offset by $6 million of actual reductions of long-term debt and other non-current liabilities. And this chart is located in the MD&A, the Management's Discussion Analysis at the front of the financial statements. Here's a snapshot of the income statement, also located in the MD&A, and I've highlighted several changes here. HUD funding actually went down $2.4 million this year. PPCA revenue, and the HUD revenue is mostly down because of the excess COVID funding that you received in 2021. PPCA revenue, which is Southwest Housing, went up $10.1 million, and that consists of about $9 million of HAP funds and then $1.1 million of admin fee represents the increase there. Other revenue of $11 million is mostly related to developer fees of Austin Affordable, in addition to the admin fee received as part of the rent program. Directly relating to that, the admin expense you see below increased to 5.6, almost all related to the consulting services related to that rent program. And HAP, the increase of $13 million, $4 million of that is HCV and the related programs, Emergency Housing Voucher and Mainstream, in addition to the $9 million of SHCC. Your change in net position down below went down $4.3 million. However, you can see 6.1 of that is depreciation expense above. So if you back out depreciation expense, you know, your equity without considering depreciation was steady and went up a little bit. So ending net position as of March 31st, 2022, $165 million of equity. Of that, $95.7 million is represented by your capital assets, less the accumulated depreciation associated with it. $55 million of it is restricted. $14 million is unrestricted. Of the $55 million that is restricted, you can see down below, $54 million of that is related to modernization and development, and that's directly related to restricted cash accounts and Austin Affordable. The only remaining items are a few reserve accounts and HAP reserves as of the end of the year, which get used up within the few months after that. Cash flow for the year, the cash increased $4.7 million to a total of 98.2 as of March 31st, 2022. Down below, you can see the breakdown of that. $40 million of that is unrestricted. And of that number, I know about $27 million is in Austin Affordable and $6 million is in the COCC. And restricted cash is $57 million, almost all in Austin Affordable related to those placement reserve accounts. Here's a snapshot of your CEFA, the Schedule of Expenditures of Federal Awards. And I'll point out this year what used to be known as the CFDA number is now known as the Assistance Listing Number. You see that at the top. None of the numbers themselves change, but the title change. On the schedule, your total federal awards for the year is $68.8 million, and of that, $61.2 million comes directly from the Housing Choice Voucher Program, in addition to the other HCV programs as part of that cluster of $65.8 total. So of your $68.8 million, $65.8 is directly from the HCV voucher cluster. However, the $480 million that SHCC gets of HUD funding is excluded from that total. And this year as well, $7 million of the Austin Affordable RAD subsidy is excluded from that amount as well. The RAD subsidy used to be included on the schedule. As of 2022, it is no longer on here. It is a footnote to that because we have separate audits for those entities now. Pathways at Meadowbrook, Pathways at Bolden, those receive separate individual audits, and they get their own single audit if the funding is over $750,000. So it's now included in that entity as well. Those federal funds are not audited part of the single audit of the authority. They're audited separately. Same as Southwest Housing Compliance Corp has been for the last few years. Any questions on any of the financial highlights for the year?
What was that that you said? Why are those properties audited separately?
That's a HUD rule where if you receive over $750,000 of federal subsidy, you're required to have a single audit for it. And we tried to get around it, but because I think like the EIN or the TIN numbers were different, they had their own identification number, they required a separate audit because it couldn't be considered part of the authority or part of Austin Affordable. They stand on their own and they had to be audited separately.
And it's also, is it fair to say that in addition to some of those properties, while they're not no longer part of this of the single audit, this audit, all of them are getting audited through because of the financing that we had to go through in order to convert them to RAD. So oftentimes there are audits with some with Cohn-Resnick, mostly with Novogradac. In addition, you have numerous investment partners who are coming in and doing their own audits and checks.
So we're audited on steroids.
I want to add one thing is that all the our RAD properties, those except for those six tax credit properties, all the information are actually included in our financial report here. It's just that do not have to be included, not stated in this section, because they receive a separate, you know, single audit. But the information, the dollar amount is part of, is included here. I just want to make it up because this is a overall audit. So we just, the different presentation doesn't report how they have to require to do. It's a little bit different because they are, those property, they are required a separate single audit. So they don't need to be in that section, but the numbers are in here. Okay.
So in this year, the operating revenue on the top left in 2022, you can see those same exact two figures, $7 million of RAD revenue and $480 million of CDCM. So new this year, we're including some performance ratios just to give you an idea of the performance of the authority compared to the last 3 years. One of those ratios is a quick ratio. As it says, this measures your liquidity and you cover your current obligations if they need to be paid immediately. This is the number of times you can pay your bills as a fiscal year end. So in 2022, your quick ratio is 8.4. And if you look back 2 years in 2020, that ratio is 5.4. The main cause of that is you've increased your cash balances and AR and prepaids by $25 million over those 2 years while maintaining consistent liability. And HUD has a goal of 2.0. That's an old number from the old public housing FOS scoring, but it's just a good metric to use. So compared to 2.0, 8.4 is very good. Another one is months extended net asset ratio, mean R. And are there enough operating reserves based on the size of your authority? So this is the number of months you can provide services if additional funding were to cease. This does not include HAP program. So no HAP revenue, no HAP subsidy, no HAP expenses included in this. For 2022, your mean R was 8.4. So once again, 2 years ago, it was 4.5. So a steady increase each year over the last 3 years. And again, it's mostly due to the increase in unrestricted cash reserves, while maintaining a current liability structure, and your expenses went up at a smaller pace.
Mr. Ritchie.
So the 8.4 represents 8.5 months?
Yes, roughly. Roughly speaking, using the factors that are included in the formula, because your current liabilities are backed out of that already.
Not including the HAP payments.
Not including
HAP payments to landlords.
Not including the HAP payments to landlords.
It does include the payments to the staff of the administrative fee.
Yes.
So that's included, but not because we expend how much per month goes out here?
About
4.5 per month.
That was a little higher.
In rental. Is it higher in rental payments?
About
5 million.
5 million a month goes out in HAP payments. That's our biggest program.
And these numbers also include Southwest Housing and Austin Affordable as well. So the HAP that goes for there is backed out as well. Occupancy rates measure your authority's ability to lease up units. If you look at this, this is just a quick formula of unit months leased divided by unit months available. And this one's actually gone down the last 2 years. So it's 99.8 in the voucher program for 2020, 97.3 this year. And Austin Affordable as well, 98.1 in 2020, and it's dropped down to 96.3. Main reason for this is due to the pandemic. Obviously, it's a lot harder to turn over units, whether it's tenant-related or the cost of actually getting the unit turned over. So it's several factors that go into why that number has dropped, but it's just something else to focus on for your authority. I think it's an area for improvement.
And of course, because this is really largely related to the pandemic, this is the trend that we're seeing for most agencies across the nation. So this isn't a unique trend to HACA itself. It's very difficult to find landlords these days. It's very difficult to, you know, keep those units fulfilled.
So that's it for the performance ratios. Here's the significant highlights for the year. As Lorraine said, there's no findings, either financial or compliance for the year. Your public housing program is now completely converted. Public housing and capital fund are nowhere to be found in these financial statements. Your equity went up $16 million 2022, and the most of the activity had to do with the ground lease deals, so $24 million of additional land and ground leases. Federal funds were over $550 million, including Southwest Housing and the RAD subsidy. And keep in mind, everything we're going over is as of March 31st, 2022, 6 months ago. And the MD&A is one of the most important things you can read as part of the financial statements to get a true picture of the authority's operations and how they've changed over the last fiscal years. And your ratios are very good. They're above the HUD goals. Lease up has slipped a couple years, and it could be an area to focus on.
Yep.
If there's any additional questions, we would be happy to answer them.
Questions? And thanks. We will put the audit as presented.
It can't hurt.
I'd like to see us accept it.
Yeah.
So I move. We accept the audit.
I second.
Motion by Commissioner Karen and seconded by Commissioner Apostolo. Is there any discussion? Hearing none. I'm going to signify by saying, hold on for a second, because before we go through, like, at every audit I've been involved with on other boards, they always ask if the board would like to have a separate conversation with just the auditors and the staff, not, and I will give you that opportunity to make that statement.
For us, if we need to have a conversation with you all?
Well, usually the auditors ask.
Oh, okay. Yes, sir.
Does the board want to have a separate conversation with the staff not present, just the auditors?
Okay. Would anyone on the board or the board members like to have a separate conversation with us without any staff present?
No, thank you.
All right. With that being said, then all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, could I just remark? So this was Barbara's first full year where she owned it. So congratulations to you and your team.
Yeah,
Barbara.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The same thing is that year in and year out, Section 8 and the housing voucher cluster. is what do we name it that? the housing voucher cluster is the biggest, it's always going to be audited and it's come in for extensive scrutiny. And I just want to give hats off to Lisa and her team for a job really well done.
Mr. Gerber, oh, Mr. Gerber, I'm sorry.
Oh, you want to talk about, let's turn it. This year will also come up for rebid of the audit. And so we're working through that process now, and Barbara will spearhead that effort. So look to that, and the board will make its decision. The other thing that I think, and I'm glad that the chairman mentioned it, is that the auditors do work for the agency, but they work for the board. And if there's an area that you all ever feel like you want to see a little more intensive focus on, be more scrutinized, take a look, go do a deep dive there, it's well within your rights to ask for that. It's also well within your rights to have a phone conversation, a Zoom conversation, or side meeting, or meeting with that staff. And I just want to make sure that it's clear that you all have that prerogative. I don't know why you want to spend extra time with Sean, but Lorianne's lovely to. But they know an awful lot about our agency, and it's helpful.
And
thank you.
Yes, and honestly, Mr. Gerber took the words right out of my mouth. We interact with it. As auditors, you think, finance, but we really are interacting with quite a few people over the various different audits that we do, compliance, HR, finance, various entities. And I just want to, give a kudos to everyone that we interact with at the agency is nothing but professional, nothing but very committed to their jobs and wanting to do a good job. And over the past, 2 years working through COVID and getting through audits and figuring that out, the team and everyone we've worked with has been great. And it's not easy to do what the agency does. I mean, to have a clean audit opinion with no findings is maybe the expectation, but it's very difficult to do. So, I just wanted to say that because there's a lot of rules and regulations and they're always changing them. And the team here is great about staying on top of all of that.
Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, good to hear.
Lorianne's been a great partner to work with. And we do take really seriously that staff, they call them, the auditors call it as they see it. Staff does not meddle, suggest, make changes. We just report information, and they call it. And in fact, the executive really tries hard to kind of just keep out of the way and let the program people do the work directly with the auditors. And I think that was the case this year.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's really important because you oftentimes see people going behind the scenes trying to change things, and that's not the way it's supposed to work.
The only time you've ever asked me to change anything, you want me to add procedures, never take them away. So you asked me to look into more things, not less things.
Can I ask one more question of you?
Yes.
Is there anything in that same vein? Is there anything that because it's weird because Edwin and I came from a place where the audits were when she started at the state agency, the audits were like this thick, and this thick, and when I left it was like that, but lots of audits, lots of audit findings, lots of things. It just struck me as weird that there weren't many here or any here. But is there anything that you think the board needs to be aware of for this coming year? As you look to changes in the economy, changes in government policy, and challenges, just things that good board members should be following and tracking.
Yeah, well, one of the items, of course, is just coming, off of COVID, and there was a litany of waivers. I actually had the pleasure of doing a presentation with Lisa at the NARO conference, so I know that she is on top of all of the changes and aware of what's happening. But just being aware that there are certain things that haven't been required of the agency for the past few years, and staff might be a little rusty on, what they need to do. And so making sure that everyone has proper training for, CMAP reporting and various inspections, various things that the agency just wasn't required to stay on top of would be one that came to the top of my head. Did you have any?
Nothing that we didn't already go over in the presentation, but just nationwide of all the authorities we audit, I mean, coming off the COVID waivers and the additional funding and just getting back to the way they were before, because a lot of them took advantage of those waivers and, you know, findings they would have gotten, they no longer received. Agencies that received a CMAP funding because they didn't quite do it right, got 2 years of break because they didn't have to get onto it. But now it's just getting back into the groove of the way things were 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And who knows, HUD funding's always random. You never know. It's going to continue to go down. You're funded way less than the 100% you should be funded at. But luckily your agency, you know, you have Austin Affordable, you have Southwest Housing mm-hmm. to, you know, add some of those extra reserves to help you continue your mission, providing low income housing to the area.
Very proactive in making that change to being maybe a more self-sufficient agency than other agencies have been and moving away from public housing and those programs into the RAD program.
I guess one of the concerns that I had via COVID was the fact that most of our staff had to work at home and remotely, mm-hmm. and whether or not that would have impacted their efficiency or any audit findings.
Mm-hmm. So, well, from a finding perspective, it didn't. Sean can probably speak to a little bit more specific because he was involved in the testing pre-COVID as mm-hmm. well as a part of COVID, and if we can call this post-COVID yet, I'm not sure. So maybe if it wasn't even a finding, did you see any changes in processes or things that, you know, maybe?
Not so much change in processes. I mean, obviously your programs have to change for your housing and your recertifications, but your agency was already going electronic before COVID hit. Mm-hmm. So you already had LaserFish up and running. You already had files scanned. So we were able to test, you know, electronic files even while we were here on site. So being off site, even if we were here, but we could test your HCV files from our home office because they were already being scanned before. So your procedures didn't have to change that much. So you're pretty much ready for the pandemic when it happened.
Now, is that typical of most agencies, or are we just ahead of the crowd?
I would say you're ahead of the crowd.
Yes.
I'm jealous that I couldn't do that for all my audits.
Yes. Yeah. We had some agencies that we had to physically go there in the peak of COVID, and we were going on the weekend. I mean, we were going on, like, Friday, Saturday to do testing so that the office was limited because they didn't even have a way to get us the information electronically. That wasn't just going to be a massive burden on staff. So I would definitely say you were ahead of the curve in that regard. And it shows a lot of agencies that were previously clean agencies in 2018-19 mm-hmm. had some findings in the past year that they weren't used to because it is just difficult when staff are a way to make sure that everything is still happening the way it needs to happen.
I'll also say your change in policy to allow your employees to work from home as needed or even when not needed just for safety concerns is going to go a long way in the next few years.
That's what I was
saying. The workforce has changed greatly the last 2 years, and now people expect to be able to work remotely. Mm-hmm. I know you're about to kick it into gear in the office a little more coming up soon. Mm-hmm. I still think it's about half and half, or you're still allowing some things, but maybe not.
No, at the properties, not so much, but within the central office.
Yeah, so, I mean, going forward, employees are going to be expected to work from home, and if you don't allow that some part of the time, a lot of them are quitting that current job and finding something else. So I think you're ahead of the game on that with your current policies you have in place.
I just read an article the other day, I think it was the Wall Street Journal, and it just said that, and it specifically cited Austin, that more people are going back into the office and more companies are requiring folks. So I'm thinking we're kind of going the other direction because in terms of the real estate community, they are starting to lease up more office space than they have, you know, obviously in the last couple of years. But the trend is kicking up because employers are requiring folks to come. So it'll be interesting to see how we grapple with that.
Yeah, it's going to be a natural progression that people are going to start going back to the office just because that's the way we've always been. But I don't think it's really going to get back to the 100% that we were before.
Yeah.
Well, there's no other questions for the auditors. Thank you all for coming out.
Thank you.
Thank
you all.
The trip. That's good to see you.
Mm-hmm. Good to see you as well.
And I hope we are back next year.
Yep. So I know on the healthcare side, we have to do the GAAP, and then there's GASP, and then there's a state regulatory.
Thank you. Thanks, Barbara.
I didn't just record my TDI, but does TDHCA require some sort of audit of housing authorities?
In regards to, I'm sorry, I missed the first part of it.
I just said, does TDHCI require audits? Because, like, I'm on the healthcare board, so TDI requires, in addition to doing the traditional government accounting standards and GASB and others, then there's another statutory audit that TDI requires all health plans and insurance companies to do. And I was just wondering, because I was just thought about that, I've never heard us talk about a state-required statutory audit that we have to do for our programs, given that we do get money for tax credit programs and stuff that they administer.
Well, most of the requirements for so TDHCA does have a variety of audits. So the answer to that question is yes. And many of them, of course, are required because of funding source. So Kelly might be able to answer that question better than me, but the answer is yes, and there's lots of audits that go on.
Okay.
At the agency.
Right, but not a financial audit like this. This is a federal requirement.
Right.
Right. No, we, for tax credit properties, we obviously do go through lots of audits, but those are typically done through Novogradic and other audit firms. So those are tied again to the tax credits. But because we don't receive TDHCA funding, so it's really more tied to, as Commissioner Carrington mentioned, the source of the funds.
Mm-hmm. A lot of audits, especially in the home CDBG programs that the department administers, again, because it's federal funds. And when Mike mentioned earlier a lot of findings, I mean, that's where initially the department got an awful lot of findings, was the administration and of the home program and CDBG.
And because we don't get CDBG funds and home funds, then they don't audit us.
Okay. I think you also find that, you know, agencies that are not successful in holding on to their staff, why do we put such an emphasis on staff tenure and, you know, the opportunity to see people trained? Somebody who's here, you know, for 2 years is in a much more vulnerable spot than somebody who's been here, you know, 10 years, 12 years, has seen changes in the program and really has the seasoning and the experience. They've made a career out of this program and, you know, have managed to handle the nuance. And now, increasingly, I think government programs, I think all programs are just, there's a lot in the nuance. We're seeing this now as we, you know, work for, I'll give you an example. We're going through the closing of Rosewood Court. It's been a weeks-long, very difficult experience because very few people here have, and very few people in, you know, that we're working with have experience with some aspects of the new environment we're working in. So it's tough. Contrast that with, you know, programs that are well-established that have, you know, 25 years of leadership, you know, and, you know, and lots of people there who have managed the program for, yeah, many years and have ridden that out. So, you know, subsequent things get, they get easier as you go along. But this has been hard. Now we're getting a little more into Yardi. Yeah. For initially when we started with Yardi, you all heard about how difficult Yardi was. Yeah. Yardi's gotten a little easier, not a lot easier, but we're working through it. So it's why longevity and tenure and treating staff well and really caring what they say. So we keep moving on the agenda.
Yeah, so do you want to go to item number 6, which is, that's an awesome affordable housing corporation to take up the transactions.
Well, do you mind if we actually go up to number 3? Because I think Ronald's going to come in here about 1:30.
Okay. Sure, we can go to item number 3, which is the presentation discussion of draft 2023 public housing authority annual plan and updates to 5-year plan.
Good afternoon, commissioners, staff, and guests. Appreciate your time on this. This is a presentation of the draft 2023 PHA annual plan and updates to our 2020 through 2024 5-year plan. No formal vote is required of the board at this time. You're just being asked to review the plans and approve staff taking those documents out for a 45-day public comment period starting tomorrow and ending December 5th. We'll return the plans to the board for final consideration at the December board meeting. The 2023 annual plan incorporates proposed changes from the Housing Choice admin plan, and then our five-year plan goals and objectives, which were updated and reflected in the five-year plan. The summary of changes were presented to you last month when Lisa presented the Housing Choice voucher plan changes. Because we're not in public housing any longer, all we report on is Housing Choice voucher admin plan changes. And then the five-year plan, we went through a strategic planning process right before the pandemic hit, and y'all reviewed those in February 2020, but we are just now, because of all the changes that were occurring, updating those goals and objectives in our five-year plan. And since some of those changes that were onset by the pandemic, we're about to refresh our strategic plan to kind of refine our objectives. We'll be starting that at the beginning of next year. So you might see another little change, but I think you liked the five-year plans and the goals and objectives when you saw them before. And we've made some headway on some of those, even while dealing with the pandemic and the changes to our operations. So we'll take these documents out for public comment, post them in a lot of newspapers. Community leaders and stakeholders will be receiving letters from us with the location on our website so they can review these and provide any kind of public comment that they would like on these plans. So, again, like I said, we'll do the public hearings, bring them back to you at the December 15th board meeting. At this time, I'd just like to request approval to post for a 45-day public comment period.
Before we approve those, yeah, include some questions, and I have some more information I want to share regarding criminal background screening criteria.
Okay.
Lisa, I think I want to engage in a little conversation with you all about, and Carl probably should be here for that. So, but Commissioner Carrington, why don't you?
Yeah, Kelly, on the process, a couple dates are wrong. You said Friday, October the 20th. It's actually the 21st.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so sorry.
And that's on the front page of this and the back page of this also. And
okay.
It's going out for public comment, and the date should be the 21st.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
It needs to be corrected.
Yes, ma'am.
Other than that, that's my comment.
I have a question regarding, I don't know if it's a Lisa question or a Kelly question. The list of vouchers and the individuals or groups receiving those vouchers, I had not been aware of that many foster youth dependent vouchers. And that whole area was something that seemed kind of new to me. Is it, or is it my?
So we received that a new award last year.
Okay.
That went to effect early part of 2022.
Okay.
75, we received 75.
Now, did we apply for that? Or?
It was a competitive grant.
Okay. So this is a serious issue then in terms of people who are leaving the foster system trying to find housing?
Yes.
And in terms of the population in Austin, how many are would you estimate?
I'm
are in that kind of need.
Sure. I'd have to check with, I don't know. I need I would have to double check with Echo and LifeWorks to see what the total.
They would have.
Okay. They would have that information.
Okay. I just hadn't considered this to be such an issue, but
yeah,
obviously it is. Okay. And we seem to be doing better in the other areas of homeless housing.
We have a lot of resources. Yes.
Yeah.
We're trying to help people get into housing that are homeless.
I mean, I know the city, and I know ECHO is supposed to be taking charge of that whole area, but are they working with the city? Are they working with HACA and all of these various agencies?
Yes. It's a coordinated effort in the city with both ECHO, the city department, what are they called now, planning and
Housing
and planning.
Mm-hmm.
Diana Lewis-Gray, who's the homeless strategy officer. So they're meeting all the time. I'm involved in a lot of those meetings, mm-hmm. too, and also the community partners.
just coming up with different solutions of how to bring forth additional resources. You know, there's a lot of rental assistance, but then also looking at how to project-based additional vouchers as well in the community and developers that are willing to participate in that as well.
Is there a great issue between attempting to find housing for the homeless or and versus those that need supportive services? And if they, I guess my feeling is that most of the people who are homeless need some kind of supportive services.
Yeah, so there's been, again, there's been additional resources put forth for both the housing and the supportive services, both by the, you know, the city. They have different opportunities that have come available, and there's, it's really everything that's being done with regards to the homeless assistance is to provide those additional resources, services right. in combination with housing.
Okay, but most of them aren't on site, correct? The supportive services. I know we have several properties where they are on site.
Most of them are not on site. No, they're not. They have a case, they have a, you know, people that they work with and manage. They don't live on the actual site where people live.
Okay, thank you.
Obviously, you know, we're in the middle of a political season. Mayoral's raised several questions asked about affordable housing, and that seems to be sort of the key issue in the mayoral race. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of conversation in this debate about homelessness, and candidates gave various answers. I just wanted to get your take on what you thought.
We probably shouldn't comment on the mayor's race.
Well, not the race, but the different proposals out there that could impact us. Do you see something out there that could negatively impact what we're doing?
I don't think Lisa, if I can feel my mind jumping in, I think that Lisa and I don't see anything that would negatively impact us. I think there are things that might have us stepping up in some different ways, and I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing. In fact, I think it's a good thing to try to help more of our homeless neighbors. I think the trick is figuring out how we meet those needs for housing, which is what we do, and have them adequately matched with the casework supports that really is the purview of so many others. That's been probably the biggest challenge we've faced. Our housing assistance goes out there, and there's oftentimes been, you know, a commitment of, well, we'll have a caseworker and maybe they'll work with that person for 6 months. And the truth is that person really needs much more extensive and intensive services, especially if they're coming truly straight from the street. You know, that person has an immense amount of unique needs, not the least of which are mental health needs that have to be addressed to get that person to a place where they can be successful in that housing. And so I think we need, that's why Lisa's work in that continuum is so important. And just continue to push the reality that, you know, that we can continue to project-based vouchers. Mm-hmm. But if we project-based vouchers and then at the end of it, those units still go, you know, the residents still can't be successful in those units because they didn't get the casework they needed, then not only did the casework piece fail, but the housing piece failed.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sort of
that's my concern.
That's the tough policy calls that I think Lisa's mm-hmm. helping to shape.
And I think in the project-based voucher scenario that, you know, we're seeing more involvement in us making more vouchers available in that, I think it's the right thing to do, because that's where you're going to have the more intensive case management services on site. It's not the solution for everyone because there's some people that have the vouchers that want to have choice of where to go.
Mm-hmm.
But it allows the community to make those decisions based on the needs of this, you know, there's a continuum. Some people that are coming off the streets and being homeless are better suited at Community First. Some are better suited at a more intensive case management type of situation, let's say at Terrace at Oak Springs. And then others might do fine in a tenant-based situation with a case manager. It just, it's in, each individual is different in what their needs are, and it allows the community and the case managers to coordinate services and make this, you know, and help with the individual that needs the help to make those decisions together of what's the best type of housing situation for them.
And is there, are there enough case management right now managers?
No.
Well, I don't really have that information.
Where in the case management?
You're talking in the
homeless system.
In the community, yes.
I don't really have the information on is there enough. I mean,
no, I don't, because I saw something in the paper where they
I'm not sure.
I don't, I mean, I personally don't think that there are. I mean, I don't think they would, I think one of the things that we don't do very well in our homeless system, and I say this to everybody listening, you know, I think that, you know, even when this board has been asked to make changes to policy, mm-hmm. we get told, hey, we've got data, and then they don't really have data. And so I don't think, I think the homeless problem is more significant.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps give credit for it. And I think the number of people who are doing both the casework piece and who do the early intervention piece, I think there's a whole lot of staff and people who are missing in that. And that's the part that's hard when we put out housing vouchers, you know, who else is going to pick that up? And frankly, if we put out housing vouchers, one of the things that we struggle with is, you know, as you see, there's a ton of compliance work that's associated with it. How do we make sure that those who we award housing vouchers to are successful? So we're really looking at the capacity of folks as well, because if they're not successful, that comes back on us. And so, you know, we really do, and I think that's a challenge for the next council and for the mayoral candidates, is to really create an infrastructure that has, you know, accountability all the way up. The housing units, those who are managing the housing units, and ensuring compliance, those who are doing the you know, the hard case work with the actual, you know, resident themselves, and the workforce partners, mental health practitioners, healthcare practitioners, job training, education practitioners who are all part of that ecosystem. You know, everyone needs to be working together, and it really the system really struggles.
Right, yeah, and I think, you know, there's always definitely work to be done on that, just to see how that can be coordinated, because there needs to be the case management, you know, for location to help them navigation mm-hmm. to get into housing, and then the after mm-hmm. they're in housing to keep them stabilized. So always there's room for improvement in all those areas. But I think that what I can say, because I've been working on this a while in the community, is I feel like the community is, I see it, it seems like they're working together stronger, in my opinion, than I've seen in the past. So I'm
gotten better.
That's my personal experience.
Let me go back to my question and just kind of be a little bit more specific. In the mayoral debate, all the candidates, one thing they agreed upon is using hotels as a way to house the homeless is not a viable strategy. And I think we've given vouchers to try to help with that, right?
To a couple of hotels, yes.
So I guess my question goes to, and that's why I was asking the negative impact, what if the city decides we're not doing that? So then is the voucher, if they decide to close that down, is the voucher tied to that property?
Yes.
Okay. And then so what happens to that voucher if they decide we're no longer going to do this, we're going to move them out, but if the voucher tied to it permanently?
No, it reverts back to us. If they go out of that business, if they sell that hotel, then the HAP contract goes away and reverts back to us.
Okay, then it reverts to tenant-based vouchers.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's,
that's where I'm going to in terms of negative impact.
Mm-hmm. So anytime, any project-based voucher contract we have, like if we have it 100%, like for instance, Terrace at Oak Springs, if they shut the doors tomorrow, then they'd have to come up with we would issue everybody there a tenant-based voucher is what would happen, and they'd have that opportunity. But that contract would go away. We'd no longer have that obligation there, and the vouchers would be tenant-based.
Okay. I'm trying to get clarification for my own edification. because maybe others may have known it, but I wasn't sure whether we just lost that voucher.
No, they're always going to be ours to have. And if there's, and when we project-based vouchers, if there's ever a situation, this happened years and years ago, I don't even remember which, it was a long time ago, but if there's ever a situation where there's non-compliance with someone that has those project-based vouchers, you know, there's steps we'd go through, is we can make decisions and contracts for non-compliance issues as well.
Okay.
And then there are always the housing authority's vouchers.
So there is a thorny issue that we need, at least that I need to share with you all, that deals with the criminal background screening criteria. As you all know, we were trying to create two different sets of screening criteria. One was intended to reflect what I think has been sort of ongoing values within the Housing Authority Board and within the authority itself, to have some tighter controls, to ensure that we don't have people getting assistance from us who have perhaps more extensive criminal backgrounds. Then there is a train of thought that we've heard from the homeless serving community about the need to go and to reduce it to just the HUD minimum screening criteria, which is the production of meth, sexual crimes, and some other drug-related.
Evicted from federally assisted housing in the last 3 years.
So those have been sort of the big three. We asked HUD for a waiver to allow us to have two different sets of screening criteria, knowing that it would be a stretch. HUD has informally responded to us that they believe they do not have the authority to allow us to go and enter into two different sets of screening criteria. So pick one or the other. This set of screening criteria only affects the Housing Choice voucher programs and the vouchers within the housing voucher cluster.
The mainstream vouchers we're talking about?
It would be all the vouchers.
Okay.
Mainstream, family unification, all of them.
Yeah, the cluster.
It does not affect our ability to put screening criteria in place for our properties that are in the big 18 that are HACA, former public housing, now RAD housing properties. Nor does it prevent us from having tenant screening criteria, tenant selection criteria in our administration of Austin Affordable Housing Corporation. Mm-hmm. So we believe that there are strong protections against having folks who would have more extensive criminal backgrounds coming into the properties and coming into AHC properties. But there is that body of folks, providers here, who feel very strongly that they want to serve and have the ability to serve and need to serve and feel called to serve our homeless neighbors and are asking us to go to the minimum three. There are also a significant body of elected officials as well who feel very strongly that, with homelessness being the priority, that we need to not create any impediment. It's my recommendation, while it's been a painful ride to get there, I think given that HUD has, I think that choice would have been better, what we had proposed, I think we're at a spot where I would respectfully urge the board and ask for you all as you tell us to put this plan out for public comment that you, in that motion, direct us to go and use the minimum criteria set by HUD and that go out for public comment as part of this plan, that we will abandon our broader tenant selection criteria. Again, I know it's not where some of us want to be, but I think we can navigate that space through other work we'll do in our other programs to make sure that we keep our properties safe and that we have residents who will work in community and work with us and keep those properties the way we that are consistent with our values. It's a hard thing.
How would you ensure that those properties would be safe? What are the methods that you're thinking of?
So the same criteria that we have here would be in our tenant selection criteria within our properties. So for those 18 properties, at each one of them, if you, you know, convicted, if you've been convicted of arson, if you've been, we would have the same standards, you know, present there. And I see Michael nodding. His team is really taking the lead in trying to navigate that space. Can you give us a quick word of how we would navigate that at the properties?
Well, we would just keep and maintain the current tenant selection plan that we have, and all the background checks and admissions, all of that continues as we've been doing.
But you said minimum.
So the minimum would be, the minimum criteria would only apply to the housing voucher programs that Lisa administers. So Housing Choice Vouchers, Family Unification, Mainstream, VASH, the standards would be lower there. But we have not wanted to go lower there because I think it was just a general sense that, you know, if you're convicted of certain crimes, you shouldn't be. But we're seeing so many homeless neighbors who are coming through with those backgrounds, and we're seeing, you know, them on the street, and we're hearing from, you know, Caritas and Salvation Army and Front Steps and others who want to serve them, but they are prevented from getting, those people are prevented from getting a voucher, even though they're coming through coordinated assessment. And most housing authorities around the country are following HUD's guidance and almost directive to go to this minimum screening criteria. Again, we were trying to thread the needle, but we just couldn't get there with them on it.
But the thing in a family public housing, you bring in, let's say, homeless.
So for any property, so basically when you receive a voucher, you have an opportunity to find a place to live,
right?
So for any person that has a voucher, the screening criteria for either the private property owner or if it's Austin Affordable or ours, whatever screening criteria that's in place would stay in place. So just because someone has a voucher doesn't mean they have access to lease a place if the tenant selection criteria or the screening criteria that they have in place at that property doesn't allow for that. So any owner in the city, if they have a criminal screening criteria in place, someone comes with a voucher and they don't pass their criminal screening criteria, they would need to have access.
Are you talking about those that have their own, that are private?
No, I'm talking about any. So for the ones that are owned up.
Let's say they go to Chalmers South.
Yeah, but whatever screening criteria Chalmers South has or Austin Pathways properties, that would stay in place. We're not talking about any of all that stays in place. So if you have a voucher, you might not have an opportunity to live there if you have certain things on your on your criminal background. So that would that's still going to be the case. And
It doesn't do away with the landlord's ability to have their own screening criteria. So like, for example, Lady Bird, even though you're using a voucher and let's say all of the screening criteria is reduced by HACA, that doesn't mean Lady Bird can't have its own housing criteria. So that stays in place.
But before, that person would not have even been able to get a voucher.
Right.
So they couldn't get a voucher and they couldn't go to Lady Bird because they would have been ruled out at both places and at both steps. Now they're going to get a voucher unless they've committed, you know, one of these three offenses that are the HUD minimums. But Lady Bird can still have in place tenant selection criteria that says we don't accept that as an acceptable background for us. It's in our plan.
And for those in the community that are making a commitment to help the homeless, the developers that want to have project-based vouchers to help people get off the streets into housing, requirement when we do the request for proposals is that they have to have low barrier screening criteria. So they have to sign up for that.
Okay.
So therefore, whatever those different properties are, they can now have a better opportunity to have a place for people that are homeless to come in, or they're going to have that on-site, more on-site case management. Because right now, even at Terrace at Oak Springs, we have to apply whatever our current screening criteria is for the regular voucher program has to apply. So there's people that really need housing that are homeless that can't get into Terrace at Oak Springs. And as we have, we're up to 391 project-based voucher units to help the homeless.
Mm-hmm.
well, there's barriers for them to get in. So this will allow for that opportunity. But yet, if you have a if you have a tenant-based voucher,
right,
and you have things on your, you might not be able to have an opportunity unless you go to a property that has low barrier screening criteria.
Okay, is that, I understand.
Okay,
yeah,
thank you.
But I would say that we're in a very difficult environment right now with just you know, not that we should be steered by the politics of things, but you know, the there's a lot in the environment which we operate in that I think is concerning and surrounds the housing debate. You know, just talking about the candidates, the mayoral candidates, and every council, you know, debate that's been held, you know, housing and dealing with strategies to address homelessness have been front and center. And I think we want to show what's truly in our heart, which is to be as helpful as we can to address that issue, but also to be mindful that we have a duty to protect our residents and our families as well. Mm-hmm. But I think this is a program where we've already been doing it in the VASH program for years.
Exactly.
Yeah, some of those folks have really rough backgrounds. But
I think about veterans.
Right? Veterans, yeah.
And
veterans.
The mainstream program has done that. We were able to for a while. And the other one, we have the continuum of care grant that we've had since 1994 with case management service required. And we've been successful. It houses about 60 people a month. But we've been successful with that, with the case management services. Where we haven't had that one's been low barrier, you know.
Why have we been successful with that one and not others? What was the difference?
In terms of others, what do you mean?
I mean, you're suggesting with that one program.
Well, I'm just saying that's an example to say that
right.
We've had a program in place since 1994 with very little screen. We're not even required to do the basic three, as well as for the VASH program. And there's case management, and we haven't had any occurrences that I can remember where there's been any serious situation that's happened with residents that were able to have an opportunity for rental assistance with case management services that, you know, had a low, hardly any criminal screening criteria. That's my point with that.
Is the case management in that program, is it mandatory? Is it required of the
tenant? There is no, you cannot have any mandatory case management for any programs, really. It's not allowed, but it's encouraged.
Right.
And they do get referrals from Integral Care. That's been our partner for years.
Mm. Okay. Oh, we saw that one.
No,
all the homeless problems. Well, I mean, I'm for it. You know, helps them out. Cause what I've seen, it's not always the homeless that are the problem. We have people who are not homeless and live there, and they cause problems. So,
yeah, I mean,
drugs. It could be their background. So
that's because we're struggling to get, you know, people out. It's hard. Our partnership with the police has been difficult. The police it's been turned very tough to get police.
And what I was saying, I don't mean to point the finger only at the homeless. It might be bringing problems to a property. We have people that are not homeless and have been in housing and their problems. It's not like one is better than the other. I didn't mean to bring that across at that.
Right.
Our efforts at lease enforcement, I mean, it's been a challenge.
Oh, yeah.
But I think for the Housing Choice Voucher array of programs, I think we're at a spot where, and I know certain commissioners will have, you know, strong opinions. I did have an opportunity to visit with Commissioner Bailey, quite a bit yesterday. And just full disclosure, as you might imagine, there's a fighting instinct there, and I get that. But I would strongly urge this board to move to have staff go and take the draft 2023 Public Housing Authority Annual Plan and 5-year plan and amend the plan to only include the three mandatory screening criteria required by HUD as we take this out for public comment.
And what are those three again?
Any member of a household has been evicted from federally assisted housing in the past 3 years for drug-related activity, or two, that the household member is in the production of methamphetamine, or that the person has been involved in is a lifetime sex offender registration. Mm-hmm.
Sex offender,
methamphetamine,
and evicted from federally assisted housing
in 3 years.
In the last 3 years.
Yeah. For whatever cause.
Correct. So if your behavior has gotten you kicked out of the program over the last 3 years, that can be used to.
So is it your behavior or behavior of a family member?
Let's see how it's
a member. If a member of the household has been evicted.
But there's always extenuating circumstances that can be presented.
Because what I recall is the whole issue came up with I guess it was a grandson or a nephew of that who did something, and then the family gets kicked out, and that was the
right.
That's what I'm trying to get a clarification. Is that
any member of the household has been evicted from federally assisted housing in the last 3 years for drug-related criminal activity.
But it's drug-related.
And they can always remove that person from the household and still gain access to
the house. They'll be there for the household.
And then there's per the mandatory, there's two others that are in there that we're keeping. One says HUCA determines that a household member is currently engaging in illegal use of a drug. That would still be included, but that's included in the federally required. And then the other one was HUCA determines that it's reasonable cause to believe that a household member's illegal drug use or pattern of illegal drug use may threaten the health, safety, or right to peaceful enjoyment of the premises by other residents. So those are in there as well, in addition to the.
So those will stay?
Yes, yeah, those stay.
But all those are really drug-related
issues. Mm-hmm. Drug-related drugs. Mm-hmm.
And they all kind of tied to the big three.
Yeah.
Yep.
So we would ask that with the staff have the ability to work within the minimum, within the minimums, and perhaps expand it on, as Lisa just clarified, and that be what we go out for public comment with.
And that the public comment period begins on Friday, October the 21st.
Correct.
Tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
So is there an amendment that's being offered?
Which is tomorrow.
I don't know if it's an amendment or a correction.
Well, you got the plan, so you'd have to amend what the plan before us, so you would need to amend the plan.
How does that fit in then to what we need to do?
Well, I think you can just simply offer a motion, and of course, you might, Mr. Chairman, offer
the parliament. There's no action needed.
There's no action needed.
There's no resolution for this. We were just we were informing you. We're putting it out, but we wanted so it'll come back after the public comment period in December, and at that time, you'd approve it. So at this point, it's a matter of informing.
I mean, staff will be reviewing the comments, and then staff will be making a recommendation to us
in December.
In
correct.
December,
but at this point, we would put it out for public comment with the changes that.
Right.
But I think we want to get a vote from you all that indicates that you're directing us to put it out for public comment,
mm-hmm.
and to do so with only the minimum criteria.
Move.
Are we making this a formal motion?
Well, what I'm getting to is in the plan, are those changes that we just discussed incorporated?
No, that I'm going to have to put.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes, for Friday.
To the plan.
Yes.
For it to go out.
I just have to.
Yes, that's right.
Is there a motion to amend the plan that they're working to release tomorrow? Because the length. But what they've just told us is not part of the original plan.
Well, it's in here. It's just not. What we're doing is we're going to strip out the other. So.
Well, you would need to. Well, okay.
So your direction. So the motion could be to direct staff to remove any screening criteria other than the HUD required mandatory denial of assistance that currently exists in the plan drafted by staff, and that it be sent out for public comment.
Oh, we could just let it go out as it is, and the staff could come back and, based on comments, take it out. No, they don't have to present it to us with that language in there. In essence, the you've got the minimum language in there, but you've got all the other components, and so when they bring it back, they just don't have to bring that back, all the additional requirements that we previously had.
Mr. Chairman, but we don't want to take the we don't want to take those other components. We really only want to offer one choice, which is just the minimum.
Arrangement of three minimums and not five.
Yes, ma'am.
But my sense is, legal aid and the other groups are going to send something in, taking them out. Because my question goes to, since HUD has said they want them out, where's the HUD letter?
Well, so I don't know that we want the HUD letter. I think we've asked a question. Mm-hmm. Through the system, and I'm not sure we're going to be. HUD letters are tend to be very prescriptive, and take away authority to do certain things. And so we've got a couple of things in here that we're.
I guess where I'm going to is HUD has said they want us to only have the minimum standards. That's what I'm looking for, the legal basis for that.
Yeah, they've informally told us that they believe that they do not have the statutory authority to go and allow us to have two different sets of screening criteria.
Because from Commissioner Bailey's standpoint, if something were to happen, he didn't want to be the one who says, and I don't think the board wants to say, oh, we just kind of willy-nilly just made this decision and something, we've kind of got a Willie Horton situation. I'd rather be saying, you know, the Fed said you need to do this, and we did it per their prescription.
Well, they didn't say we need to do the minimum screening criteria. They said we need to do the They said we need to have one set of screening criteria. And so, you all pick locally. But if we choose not to go with the minimum, then we know that our homeless providers won't be able to, who feel very strongly about being able to serve folks, won't all be able to access these programs the way they are, the way they wish to see them and people able to participate in them. And that might cause us other challenges.
So we want to be able to have an amendment to approve to go out for public comment just with the minimum screening criteria.
That's what staff is recommending.
Yes.
That's what staff is recommending. I know it's an uncomfortable and awkward change, but I think that it's I think we're just at that place. I think that were we to send out multiple sets of criteria, I think we will have very few who will support one. We got no support for this criteria that we wanted last time. We got you had a room full of people who said we want this other screening criteria. And we're expecting you to make changes, and we bought ourselves some time last time. And now I think there's more evidence that the screening criteria we had in place hurt our ability to serve folks in the homeless community, and I think that we will hear extensively were we not to make changes, which is why I think staff is making the recommendation. I think Lisa and her groups have and her stakeholder groups, as much as no one likes being pressured, it's very rare that I think staff comes and says, we really think you got to make a change. But this is a case where I think we are in pretty uniform agreement that we've got, this change is going to come one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's got to be a motion because the plan as presented to us is not includes language that you don't want to have in it. So there's got to be a motion to take it out or to amend it. So you've got to do something procedurally. Otherwise, we approve it as is, and then you're saying
right. You've
got language in there that you don't want. So I'm saying the floor is open to make a motion to amend the plan
either to remove whatever language or to basically to approve the plan with just the minimum criteria. But there has to be a motion.
So Cheryl, would it be appropriate for staff to suggest two motions? The first would be that a motion be made to remove anything but the mandatory denial of assistance that's reflected in the policy.
Criteria that's established by HUD.
And that be the only thing that remains in the plan. That be step one. And then we go to step two to put it out for public comment.
The floor is open for a motion. This one's just saying the floor's open.
Would one of the commissioners make that motion?
I make a motion to.
I'll second that.
Thank you, Commissioner Amistola. And thank you, Commissioner Duffinall.
So, Nidhi, do you have the language?
Yes. And I'll bring it back. I mean, I'll play it back to you. To amend, remove, three criteria.
The motion is to remove all screening criteria except the mandatory denial of assistance screening criteria currently in the plan.
So there's a motion by Commissioner Costello, seconded by Commissioner Duffinall. Is there further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, signify saying aye.
Aye.
All right, so the plan has been amended. So now we're back on the main motion, and that is to amend. So the amended plan will be issued tomorrow.
Yes, for public comment.
For public comment.
Yes. Or through the December 5th.
Yes.
So.
Motion.
Can it be shorter?
No.
Yes.
No, it's 45 days.
This one has to be 45.
I'll make that motion that the plan go out for public comment beginning tomorrow, October the 21st. Second.
As amended. Motion by Commissioner Carrington, seconded by Commissioner Apostello. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries.
Mr. Chair, just confirm all those, both those were unanimous?
Yeah, they were.
Thank you very much. Everybody feel nice and manhandled?
No, this is
tough. This is a very tough one for staff. Chairman, I think we want to now turn to the Austin Affordable Housing Corporation agenda. I think the St. John's folks are here. Yes, ma'am.
Ethan wants to have Lupa Garcia.
Yes. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah.
He's
been sitting here.
Deny, decline, oppose.
No, just yell. I'm sorry. Lupe, who's so vigilant.
So we're
I've learned here. A lot.
City
Advisory Board
update.
Okay, perfect.
Okay.
Hey.
Okay,
I'm
going to
send you.
Hi, Lupe.
Oh, my God. Meeting was called to order 10:44 by, of course, Nidhi Lupe Garcia. Presentation, Mike, shared that the Haka is working close to Rosewood and that Santa Rita will be next property to be redeveloped and perhaps the next site will be next. Alani Villegas provided updates on behalf of Michael Law. Thank you to all the residents, council leaders who coordinated very successful national night-out events across all our properties. The Haka Committee developed announcements. Catherine Crago shared digital inclusion updates. 15 IMLs will be graduating, and they will be receiving laptops from digital inclusion. There are Metro Bikes and e-bike stations at Chalmers, Rosewood, Lakeside, Santa Rita. Residents had an opportunity to test the bikes and get 1 free year of membership. Lonnie Villegas mentioned that beginning Monday, October 24th, HACA will be operating at 50% capacity. Austin Pathway staff will be on property at least 3 to 4 times per week. Robert Jackson provided youth education success updates. Andy Fernandez provided Rosewood home ownership program updates on behalf of Daniel Ruiz. Murphy Rowland shared workforce development updates, and there's a new community health worker certification program in partnership with the City of Austin. Delana gave bringing health updates. Mobile vaccination clinics will be available at Gaston, North Duke, and Booker T in November. New business, Emma Homeshare National Night Out kickoff event. The next citywide board meeting will be Lakeside, October 11th, which that was another Lakeside. Citywide board spent $200 on food and flowers for Isaac Robinson, former resident commissioner. Veronica Castillo Perez is the new president of Chalmers Resident Council. She stated, we had a very successful national night out. I, Lupe Garcia from Santa Rita, shared that we had a cupcake walk and a bounce house for national night out. The new residents of Santa Rita were very excited to join the first national night out, which we had like maybe 7 residents. Steve from Rosewood was pleased to hear the national night out was a success at Salinas. He also stated they were very happy with their relocation. Diana Hancock from Coronado had bingo, and she was very thankful for the members of the executive team participation and helped out during the national night out. The meeting was adjourned at 11:51 a.m. Now, updates.
Good job.
Yeah.
Thank you.
One question. Everyone seemed to be enjoying the national night out, but how many participants did we have at the various properties? Do you have any idea?
I don't. I had, I do a sign-in sheet, so I know I had 56.
Okay.
And that's not including the kids.
Yeah, it varies for properties. So, Booker T. Washington had close to about 150 to 200.
Oh,
yeah. Chalmers had about 100. Lakeside had about 75. And the smaller properties maybe had like 25. Selena maybe had 15. So it varies, but a lot of people did come out.
Yeah, well, that's
very good. It was an outdoor event.
Yeah, right.
All the properties.
Well, that's more than I thought. Yeah. So very good. Glad to hear it.
And it was good. So my an update on my IMOS that I'm very proud of. Right now we're up at 42 members.
Excellent.
And so they did get the desktops in October week ago, and so we're waiting for the other 7 to get theirs probably next couple of weeks.
Now, in your last report, you mentioned that quite a few were involved in taking classes, et cetera. Do you keep a count on that so that you can report to us on a regular basis?
Yes. Right now I have 16 that are either taking classes, GED, or going to ACC, and then I have 13 that are working, that have gotten jobs with HEB, at the airport, Ross, all different, and some even with the city of Austin. So
I think that that's a very good result of that organization coming together in such a short period of time.
Yes, we're at 7 months now.
Very good.
So, yeah.
And I can vouch for that because I go to all of them. So.
Yeah, Mary vouches.
I mean,
our room's getting a little tight, but we're there.
That's a good problem to have.
Oh, we'll buy a new building for you.
Got harder.
Next month we'll have to vote on a little bit more grant money because she's
over. I'm
dwindling.
I'm over.
She's got a lot of participants that have gone.
Yeah, I'm having to use both community rooms just because it gets like I have speakers. I have, people that are coming in, offering. Then I have the IMOMs, and then I have the children because we do provide, like, a little daycare. So I'm having to use both rooms now so that it gets an impact. So, but, we.
Definitely. Let's figure out how we.
Success breeds problems that are solvable.
Yes.
But thank you so much, and I enjoyed it. I learned a lot, though.
Thanks, Lupe. Appreciate your leadership.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to switch over to the Austin Affordable Housing Corporation agenda. Thanks to our friends for being so patient. Item number Well, Commissioner Cassidy, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Yes.
Your chair, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The meeting has been called to order. Quorum has been established. And the next item is public communication. Is there anyone, Nydia, who signed up for public communication? Okay. None, and we will move on to the consent agenda. So I need a motion to approve the consent agenda for our meeting of
September. So moved.
Okay.
Second.
Okay, Carl makes the motion. Mary makes the second. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Under the action items, item number two is an update on future developments, and I believe that is Mr. Kowal.
I'm going to stand up for a second since I can see y'all down there. Thank you, Madam Chair, Commissioners, staff. Item number three is actually no action item. We're just going to want to update you on a project we've been working on for a year and a half. If y'all are familiar with the old Home Depot site on I-35 and by the St. John's area, that is a project that we are working on with our partners, which you seem going to believe. And we thought at this time, since we've spent a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of community engagement, and we're making some significant progress through the planning stage of getting this off the ground, we thought it would be a great opportunity for us to spend a brief little bit of time to introduce the project to you, introduce the team to you, and kind of let you know where we are and what we've done to this point. Again, there's no action to be taken. We've still got some time to go before we get to where we want to be, but we've made some very, very significant progress. But I thought you'd enjoy meeting the team and hearing some of the engagement and some of the processes that we've all been through. So I'm not going to speak much. I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Laura Cortez, who has just been fantastic to work with and has been our fearless leader through this whole process and working with the community and all. And I'm going to turn it over to her and let her walk you all through where we are. Thank you very much.
Laura, why don't you come up, and anyone would like to sit around the table, just hold the chair. Feel free to.
Our first speaker we're going to have is Christine Frendel, who's a member of our team, and then I'll speak a little bit on community engagement. We're going to turn it over to her for the first group of slides.
Hello. Christine Frendel. I'm a redevelopment project manager with the City of Austin Economic Development Department. And this project goes back pretty far for the City of Austin. The community itself dates back a couple hundred years, but as far as this redevelopment process began around 2008, when we purchased the former Home Depot site as part of the 2006 general obligation bonds. A few years later, we then purchased the site directly north to it to create almost a full block, also using bond funds. And originally, the city purchased it to put a new public safety facilities there. Not much happened with the property until 2017, when staff was directed through much community engagement and advocacy from Councilmember Kazar to work with the community to come up with a new vision for the property that could actually serve the adjacent community around the site. In 2019, an additional resolution was passed, which directed staff to negotiate an agreement with the University of Texas. And they came onto the team as part of the 2 years of community engagement, providing input on feasibility studies and also doing some test fit scenarios for what type of development could occur there. In 2020, after 2 years of really robust community engagement, again led by Councilmember Kazar at the time, a new vision came forth and was adopted by the Austin City Council, and they also initiated a request for proposal process to look for a development partner who could implement the vision, the community vision. Next.
I had a question.
Yes.
Go back to the agreement with UT, that's for UT to provide support, because UT doesn't own the property, right?
No.
Okay.
The two properties are owned by the City of Austin. It was an interlocal agreement with the Center for Sustainable Design to help the city look at some possible test fit developments along with the community on, you know, what types of development scenarios could occur. It was really a first pass and a first look to see, you know, based on the three major goals that were identified by the community, which was affordable housing, publicly accessible open space that could be multi-generational, as well as local and nonprofit spaces for local and nonprofits that could serve the direct community adjacent to the site.
Okay. Do you have a map that you can project?
Yes, but we will get to a map.
That's coming.
Yes, coming. Move forward? Okay. So in September 16th of 2020, staff did issue a request for proposal for the entire roughly 19-acre site. And as I mentioned before, the three main community goals that served as the foundation, not just for the RFP, but for the scoring and selection of the development partners, was that it would be a mixed-income, mixed-use district with affordable housing, particularly accessible to current and past residents of the neighborhood, that it would provide open space for creation and recreation and congregation, and that there would be space for community retail and support services that are needed in the St. John neighborhood. On March 2nd, the advertisement closed. And over the course of 3 months, a multidiscipline panel that included experts skilled in economic development, finance, affordable housing, parks and open space, looked at all of the proposals and in the end recommended Graystar Development Central LLC, which is the partnership between Graystar and the Housing Authority of the City of Austin. In July 29th, we came back to council and they approved our ability to negotiate an exclusive negotiating agreement with the Graystar development team. And then in 2022, after several months of negotiations, we executed that ENA and then moved forth with the negotiation of a master development agreement, which is what we're currently in right now. Additionally, on June 16th, 2020, Council did pass a resolution that allowed staff to negotiate an agreement where we could sell the property to the Public Facilities Corporation, which is controlled by the Housing Authority of the City of Austin. Next. So this is the site. The site is located along the frontage road of I-35. But also within the triangle created by I-35, 183, and 290, right in the heart of the St. John neighborhood. Directly adjacent to the site is the St. John's Neighborhood Park, existing park, which was recently improved by the Parks and Recreation Department with a new shelter and vegetation and an art and public places sculpture. The Interstate 35 road creates the western boundary of the site, while the eastern boundary is made up of the St. John mostly single-family neighborhood. The parcels to the north and south are comprised of low-density commercial uses oriented mainly towards the I-35 service road. In close proximity to the site are the Virginia Brown Recreation Center, Pickle Elementary School, and St. John Public Library to the northeast. Additionally, the St. John Regular Baptist Association is also located to the northeast. Across I-35 and along the St. John Avenue is Webb Middle School, and moving further west, St. John Avenue ends at Crestview Station, which is anchored by the Crestview rail stop operated by Capital Metro. Next.
Let me ask you, where's the park on here? I'm trying to find it.
Can you? Thanks, Jody.
Small.
It's really a small kind of pocket park.
It's a pocket park. It's 0.79 acres, so not even quite an acre.
The reason why I'm asking, because I used to live up in this area, and I never saw that park.
It's only accessible through a dead-end road off of Bennett, so it's a little difficult to get to at this point. We'll have some of the other team members talk a little bit more about how we're looking to integrate that existing park into new open space and how and better connect it into the existing neighborhood. So the former Home Depot tract, and Jody's going to help me because she knows this too. So the former Home Depot tract is located to the south. That's the southern property, and it's 13.8 acres. The property to the north is 5.2 acres, and so together there are roughly 19 acres comprising mainly a full block except for one bay of single family that runs along Bennett Avenue. I won't bore you with zoning unless you want me to, but just to say that we are in the process of rezoning the properties to CSMUVNP as directed by council. The current zonings do not allow for any sort of higher density multifamily or commercial
to go onto the site. Back up and explain what those acronyms meant?
Sure. So CSMUNP, CS means that it's commercial. It allows for a mix of uses. That's what the MU stands for. So that means that we can put both residential and commercial on the site together.
Okay.
And the NP indicates that it's part of an adopted neighborhood plan, which is the St. John Coronado Hills neighborhood plan.
Okay. And does this neighborhood plan call for the demolition of the existing building that's there?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, the building, we've already demolished the buildings on the Chrysler dealership. We had a fire during the pandemic, and we discovered that the majority of the buildings had asbestos in them. So we worked with the federal government to remove those buildings and scrape the site to the north. To the south, the Home Depot site has been in disrepair for a very long time, and currently it's not occupiable and not safe to occupy. It would take quite a bit of money and work to even get it up to speed. And so the path forward, which also allows us to implement the community vision, is to also demolish that building as well.
And who pays for demolition?
It will all come out of the project as a whole.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question about the topography, if I remember correctly, and it's been a while since I've been there. It was not level.
No.
Pretty, I guess, kind of almost like on a slope.
Yes. Yeah. And
what are you all going to do in terms of the development to address that?
When we get,
my sense is that's going to drive expenses.
We'll get to it when Carson goes up and talks about a little bit about it, and David will share what the plan looks like and how that's going to be addressed here shortly.
Okay. And then can you go back to the map? Yeah.
Got a couple more maps coming too that'll show kind of what the site is planned to look like. That'll be a little bit more visual for you.
Well, I'm just trying to think back to when I used to live in this area and some of the issues that I used to think about when I would pass by it.
I mean, it's a very astute observation. It's one of the largest challenges that we have on the site. So between the Home Depot and Chrysler site, there's 16 feet of drop, and there's a retaining wall. So our team members who are working on the design of the site can talk a little bit more about how we're going to address that challenge.
So what's on the, which would be the south, so directly across from the Home Depot parking lot going back south. What's that right there? I see the white building. What's that right in there?
That's a multi-story, I think, office building.
Right. Okay. And to the north is the post office. So off of Flaxon, you would have the post office. There's also a restaurant supply store there.
I guess.
If that helps you order.
Yeah. What I'm looking at is right in here.
Burger King.
There's a Burger King.
I know what's
Burger
King on the corner.
I mean, the reason why I raise this is because, again, this was 20 years ago. I used to live up in this area, and I would get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and drive down there and go across the Lincoln Center and work out at that gym. But there used to be a lot of prostitution right there at that corner.
There is definitely still some challenges that we'll need to work on as far as folks that are occupying the site, and we're working with the city's homeless the homeless coordinator to talk through some of the issues about how we can relocate and connect these folks with programs that are available.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't so much homeless, but it was just a lot of criminal activity in it right there at that time of day. And I think part of it was, it's a Home Depot, you got truckers coming in, making deliveries, and it was just, I mean, some of the stuff I saw, like, dang, in the morning.
That is some feedback that we've received in our community engagement so far has been criminal activity around the park and how that's prohibited community members from feeling comfortable using the park. So it's something that we hope to help alleviate with the new site plan. But that has continued, fortunately.
So since you got the information, it means you're on top of it, and you'll figure out a strategy to address it. That's a good point.
And this is my last slide, and this is really just to let you all know this is following up on that zoning rezoning that we're doing. So because the sites are under an approved neighborhood plan, we also have to amend what the city calls a future land use map to make the future land uses compatible with the proposed development as well. So this slide is really just speaking to the fact that that is also in process.
And how long will the zoning case take?
We have already gone to, there has to be two public hearings for zoning and neighborhood plan amendments. We completed the first on October 11th at Planning Commission, approved it on consent, and we will be going back December 1st to the council meeting for full rezoning approval.
Okay.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from the community?
Thank you for asking.
I do segues.
Yes. My name is Laura Cortez, and our team actually supports public engagement for this particular project. And one of the key lessons that we've learned doing our community engagement work is the importance of history. Long before there was a Home Depot or Chrysler site, that land belonged to a thriving African-American community that calls and still calls St. John's their home. We believe this is important to acknowledge because these truths and ensuring that we work from a place of service, collaboration, and inclusion. In acknowledging this history, prior to our team joining this project, there was 2 years of robust community engagement, as Christine mentioned, that was led by former member council member Greg Kassar, the University of Texas at Austin, and many community leaders. This engagement process led to this vision statement, which you see outlined here today. And this vision statement is alive and well, and one that we take with us through this next phase of the project. And it, too, is the vision of our project. And I like to read this because I do believe it's important to share. This was what the community decided they were going to lead forth with. So this vision is to complete a complete community and a historic neighborhood by reinforcing its strengths and enhancing its services and quality of life through redevelopment.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
And this, you may not be able to answer this, but I just got to ask this. So St. John's neighborhood in Clarksville, they were one of the two, I would say, African American enclaves that were not part of the 1928 council decision.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I just wanted to get that clear. Wanted to get that up.
Yes, absolutely. So with this vision statement, we want to share this next slide here with you and go into the community engagement and what we've been working with. So since July 2022, we've been working diligently to re-engage the community. We've had small group meetings with key stakeholders. We've attended community meetings and events. We designed an online survey and hosted one in-person public meeting that consisted of a resource fair and one virtual public meeting. But we launched this with several other activities, as you can see there. We went to a Meet the Teachers night. We attended the School Alliance meeting. We went block walking and met 200 residents. We did apartments and homes. And then we've most recently launched our first community advisory committee meeting. We have about 16 members that will be taking part in this process and that we will continue to be meeting. Next slide, please.
Before we go to the next
slide. Oh, sure.
I'm just curious about the walking tour with Grandma Wisdom.
Yes.
Do you mind telling me what that was?
Sure, absolutely. That was a very exciting and fun opportunity for our entire team. We have a photo to show you in one of our slides, but just to share, Grandma Wisdom has long, her family owns property in the St. John's community, but she's long been an advocate for children and the education of children and the space in which we are operating to ensure that there is
things for children to do in the community. So we all had an opportunity to spend time with her. She's been featured by Oprah. She's been featured many times. And I believe when I last spoke to her, she was on her way to Washington, D.C., and the vice president was actually going to be acknowledging some of the work that she's done. So we have engaged her in our process, but we also want her voice to be very relevant because she has such a history of what's happened in this community.
And if you go into her home, it's basically designed as a museum of St. John's and the history of St. John's since she was 7 years old, I think is what she told us. And you can go through and she'll explain to you all, this is from when I was 14 and we used to have this there. So her passion of, you know, reconnecting this neighborhood to the vision that they had so many years ago and now has been displaced is really important to her. So she's been a really great, great motivational person.
Sounds like.
Yes. Then this next slide here is just some of the numbers we wanted to share with you. The surveys that we've had online, the attendees that we had at a resource fair, that was really exciting. We had about 15 to 20 vendors that came out and joined us. We received over 125 comments from the community, which we're integrating into our project. And as you can see there, we also attempted to gather surveys also in person so we can better understand who we're speaking to and the demographics. We had to do engagement in a very short period of time. Christine could probably tell you that traditionally engagement processes last anywhere from 12 months to 18 months. We had to do this very quickly in an 8-month period of time. And we utilized various different strategies to do that. So we're speaking to people who want to still be online, going to people door to door, as well as hosting an in-person meeting where we had several members come up to us and say, we've never had this at St. John's. So we're hoping we're changing the way in which people are involved in processes. Yes, sir.
So in terms of the St. John community per se, how many households is that?
That's a good question, sir. I don't have that available to me, but I block walked about 200 homes, and that is just around the Pickle Elementary, Virginia L. Brown area. But this, and Christine, I don't know if you know how many houses are in that area.
Well, no, I don't.
So, but we definitely are making sure that it is an expansive group of individuals that we're looking at, not just a particular space. One of the things that I think is also important that I'll be talking to you in the next slide here is our community advisory committee has parents, students, individuals who work in special expertise and professions. So we're making sure that we're having all voices that you would traditionally not see on a CAC be involved in this public engagement process.
So when you think of St. John's, I think St. John's is just a little, so Webb Elementary going all the way back to Cameron Road.
Yeah.
And then stopping there at, what's that? That's 180, is it?
183.
183. Uh-huh. And then going to 290.
Mm-hmm. And that's the triangle that Christine had mentioned that we think is really important is I-35, 183, and 290, which provides you this network of families who are living in these spaces. We have to ensure that we're involving them in the process. Many of them live in apartment homes, so it's important for us to hear why are they in those spaces, but then there are residents who have lived there all their lives. Or we're also hearing family members who own homes there, and they're now coming back as their families have either passed away or left their homes to them generational. So we have generations of individuals who this project is going to be very important to. So these are some of our pictures. There's Grandma Wisdom. As Ron mentioned, this is a picture of her home. She has things all over her wall. If you ever get an opportunity to go there and meet her, there's a picture of our team out there. There's me acting goofy. This is kind of just to give you a visual of what we put at some of our meetings. And we continue as a team to always look at data and how it's informing the decisions that we're making. Our block walking experience. And then this is a picture, the last three of us out at the resource fair. You can see quite a few people walking around and the various different vendors that we have. We always make sure that our materials are in multiple languages as needed. We have a very high Spanish-speaking population as well in this area. So it was wonderful to see them with their children and being involved in providing feedback. And there's our colleague, Jody. We did some evening events getting out there in the community.
So is that Webb or elementary, or is it Reagan High School? And that's what I was going to ask you about, because the residents in that area would attend Reagan High School.
Which is now Northeast High School, yes.
Absolutely. And I was going to ask you about sort of, are you also getting sort of the corporate citizens in that area? Because you've got a couple of businesses, I mean, Papados, Papacitos, Academy, in terms of how, you know, they may have some input into it in terms of, and I'm not sure what they would say, but obviously they would want to have some say in it, especially in the zoning part portion of it.
That's great feedback and input. We started with the community first. This is a mixed-use affordable housing space, so it's really going to be for people that are going to be living there. But I think you bring up a good point. We have not started our business engagement, but that is a very important aspect that we do with all of our projects. In the short period of time we had, we wanted to make sure the people who are living there were the first people we went to. And more importantly, we took the stakeholder list that was done over the 2 years of the process, and we contacted those individuals first. And the reason for that is that many times those people that have dedicated 2 years of their life being involved, and then we had COVID, their main thing is, what have you done and what's happened in between that time? So as a strategy, as a team, we knew that was the first group of people we needed to speak with. And in fact, many of them were very excited. They were like, we wondered what happened, and we provided them an update. Part of public engagement is to making sure people understand what's happening and what's happened since they've been involved. So that was our strategy, but I love your suggestion, and I think it's something very important we can include.
Yeah, and well, I'm kind of glad that you're starting with the residents, because my sense is if, you know, Papados, Papacitos, and the other corporate folks, they would be excited about the fact that there's affordable housing there, because they would look at it as workforce housing. And so, you know, you'd have everybody wants the housing, but you'd have competing interests. You'd have the residents who's in there wanted more housing or higher quality of housing, and then you've got the corporate folks who want to have sort of housing.
Absolutely.
So just to give everybody just a quick time check. So probably have another 15 minutes or so on this, because we have other issues we have to bring before the board. So I know you want to move. There's a lot of history here, but maybe give us an abbreviated and kind of move us to the plan and maybe some specific things I know we're going to need from the board sooner rather than later.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, thanks.
This just shows you a visual of who we have on the CAC. We're actually could provide that to you, but this is a 16-member CAC that we sat. And then on the next slide we just have here, we wanted to show you, we won't go into the details of this, we can always provide it to you in a written packet, but this is the kind of way that we've done community engagement, and we wanted to gather feedback on the amenities. One of the big things of this project is learning what do people want to see in the park, but more importantly, the benefits of this project. So this just breaks down the data. There's quite a bit there, so just for the sake of time, we wanted to show you a visual of what we've heard and what we've seen. And then what's coming next? This is our engagement timeline. You can see there. We'll be going to council very soon, and we'll be hosting our next CAC meeting in November. And then this just shows you the variety of what I've already shared with you of all the different strategies that we use to engage the public. And then I'll just end with our upcoming events. Hope to see many of you at Hope Fest this weekend. We'll also be at the St. John Home Missions Health Fair on November 5th. We'll be hosting our next community advisory meeting on November 9th. And then we'll be sharing some time with the Virginia L. Brown community November 17th. So with that, I'll turn it over to David. With Graystar, he's going to go over the framework plan.
Thank you, Laura. Good afternoon. Thanks so much for having us. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for the opportunity. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the programmatic elements of the proposed redevelopment. So we were really so lucky that when we came into this project, as Laura mentioned, that there had been 2.5 years of community engagement led by former council member Kassar. So we really weren't starting from scratch with what does this community want in this location.
So with the RFP in hand, we were really armed with some great information about the desires of the community, about what should go onto the site. So that was the RFP as well as the University of Texas study that Christine mentioned that aggregated all of that feedback over the couple of years. So just to reiterate real quick, the main priorities that came out through the UT study and were emphasized in the RFP was mixed income housing. It was open space for congregation and recreation, and it was a commercial space set aside for specifically tenants that would serve the St. John community. And then the fourth one is to recognize the history of the St. John neighborhood in some way or another. So that part is a little bit more abstract. But so how we're addressing the requirements of the RFP and the feedback that came from the community is to include for the mixed income housing 560 apartment homes. 50% of those will be affordable. That will average below 60% MFI. We've been working with Ron and Suzanne, came up with 50, 60, and 70% MFI tiers so that folks can stay within the community maybe as their economic position changes. They don't have to seek other housing. So that's the housing component. The roughly 1 acre park that exists, we're looking to expand that significantly, as well as provide new improvements to the park, such as a multi-generational splash pad, performance pavilion, community garden, walking trails. The commercial space, we've proposed 15,000 square feet, and we've been part of the community engagement that Laura and Jody have helped us with is receiving more feedback about specifically which tenants the community could most utilize in that space. So we're armed with some more data on that front now. And I'm going to pass it over here to Carson to talk to you about kind of how we've laid it out. I'm not the designer, so I did some Excel work and said, let's go put all this in. And then I called Carson and said, hey, can you help me? We have 19 acres, and here's all that we need. So I think with that, I'm going to pass it. But the last bullet, spoiler, really trying to focus on connection to and from the current neighborhoods so that those residents, so that this can really serve them, not just the 560 new apartment homes, but make it accessible to the neighborhood.
Carson. So my name is Carson Chapman. I'm with TPG Partners, Landscape Architects and Planners, and we've had the pleasure of working alongside David and Laura and Ron to make this plan come true. And so we're working right now on siting and designing a lot of the elements that David just mentioned into a cohesive plan, getting the feedback from the community in order to locate them. So we've talked quite a bit about the existing site. You know, a couple of things to note is that existing park, it's just under an acre. It's really kind of hiding right now behind the Home Depot. And then also, as we talked about, there's a lot of great change on this site. Your rough high point is the southwest corner at St. John's and the 35 Access Road. And everything generally slopes north and northeast to Blackson at that northeast corner. Yeah, thanks. So moving into the site plan, this is our current iteration of the site plan, which, again, we're still receiving feedback and making modifications as we go, but want to hit on a few key items here. Certainly the housing is a very critical component of this plan. So currently the layout is to have two multi-storied multi-family structures on either side of a main boulevard that cuts east to west through the site. These will be, again, as David mentioned, the partially market rate and partially affordable units. They will also be equally dispersed throughout the buildings. So it won't be that one structure is market rate and one structure is affordable. There'll be a mix all the way from studio up to three bedroom sizes. We do have
– that'd be true across the both buildings. So a three bedroom in the front is as good as a three bedroom in the back, and there's no that unit's affordable and that unit's – okay. Everybody can live everywhere.
Exactly. For the commercial space, we currently have it sited along the 35 frontage road. We're starting to get some great feedback from the community on what they might like to see the tenants of these areas. Anything from a small grocer to get food access, youth development, health services, things like that. We're continuing to gather that feedback as well. And then lastly, as we move through the site to the east, a big component is the expansion and the preservation of the existing park. We want to acknowledge the work that's been done over the past several years by the community to really enhance that park with the pavilion and swings and playground. But we'll also be expanding that quite significantly, both northward and southward. The north part there, which, as we said, is the low point of the site, will be used for water quality and detention, which will be a requirement for the development of the site. But the southern portion that stretches from the existing park to St. John's will be redeveloped as park space. Amenities, again, we've talked about the splash pad. We really want to listen to the community in terms of setting the stage for what types of amenities they'd like to see, from walking trails to community gardens and potential to have events and, you know, market days, things like that at the neighborhood. So this is still in flux. We had a great meeting this past Tuesday with the CAC, who had some great feedback on the plan itself. And we're looking into, you know, how to explore some different site plan changes and how to better integrate the uses on the site. For example, you know, is there a way we can get some of the units facing and fronting the park space directly without having to cross surface parking, as an example? And so, you know, there's still plenty in flux here, but all of the key elements are communicated on this plan here.
What change?
I think that's it.
So I'm just looking at that. Yeah. So just looking at, there's a lot of, there's still a lot, be a lot of cement there.
Mm-hmm.
Are you using affordability unlock to reduce the parking at all?
No.
We didn't. Our parking ratios are pretty much in line. If
you have
not,
to remember, we've got over 500 units.
Yeah.
So that amount of parking plus the parking for the park and parking for the commercial really isn't that much parking. I mean, because you don't really see the scale of the building.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we're still looking at it, and that's it's a great point. It's been brought up to us how many times? That, you know, I mean, you know, obviously we can't do garage parking. I mean, the cost is just astronomical to do, and that would have been a great option. And we're somewhat, you know, we're just constrained because of the financing piece of it. But like I said, we're still in tweak process, I think I would say. So we're a long way away from finalization. But that's been one of the most common themes to us, is that there's a lot of surface parking.
Well, I guess I'm just thinking, sort of more of a climate type of deal. The more cement you have, the more heat you generate.
The more what?
The more cement there is, the more heat you generate. The sun hits that cement and it just boom. Right. And so in terms of, I guess what I'm thinking of, and maybe it's just sort of the size of the schematic, I'm just thinking there needs to be more kind of green space where that parking lot is, but if there are 500, the 500 units, you've got to have enough parking to accommodate that.
What's our parking?
But I'm just thinking, because when you look at it, you got the highway, that's heat. When that sun hits it, when it's 103 or 95, that's heat that's coming off that cement. Then you got more heat in there. So to me, it's a hot spot. Mm-hmm. Now I'm not sure how you address it other than with more green, you know, trees, bushes, flowers, plants, stuff like that. But I'll let you guys figure it out now. That's just something that just pops off to me.
We're at 1.25 parking spots per unit, kind of how we do. And that's also trying to accommodate parking for a community to access the park. also the shopping, of course, the rest of the retail. And there's a lot of concern about safety, you know, and criminal activity and parking break-ins and car break-ins and how we're going to address that as well. So we're talking about maybe fencing in the property itself, but maybe moving the clubhouse maybe outside to where it sits outside in the park, but that's separate from the units themselves. So again, it's all community feedback and tweaking. Got some really, really good partners that can figure this stuff out. And I'm not the expert in that. So that's why we have Carson.
Is it commercial? Is it just those two paths or is it more on the
block? It's just those two.
It's those two paths. Yeah.
Two paths. And that size right there is roughly 15,000 square feet.
And the revenue generated, correct me if I'm wrong, the revenue generated, we're thinking that will come off of those spaces will go directly back into the community, into the complex itself, correct, for service, for the supportive service side of it?
We're going to need to.
Right, yes. So that's not, I mean, that, so the money that we generate from the retail will then go back to support the we plan on doing a, you know, many, many, many community service things there. We just don't know what it is until we get the tenant base and we get that out. We've got lots of options that, and we've taken community feedback during our presentations and in the meetings we've had to see what's the most important that the neighborhood wants to see. So there were some surprising results. Things I thought would have been front and foremost were not. Were toward the bottom.
Like
childcare would be.
Oh, childcare is not considered.
It seemed to be not really a big ask as much as more youth development, so that 5 to 11-year-old range, I think, is what we've basically seen more than just childcare itself.
It has to reach 5.
I was surprised at some of the things. But so we're still tweaking. We're at a point where we felt we've made some good progress. We've got things to show, and we felt it'd be important for you all to see it. Love and you have time to add feedback down the road. We'd come back to you again as we continue to tweak this a little bit and get further down the road. But I wanted you to meet the team. There's no action to be taken. I don't think anything in the near future will be coming to you. We've still got a long process to go before we get there. But it's something that Suzanne and I really, really embraced over the last year. She's just been a champion in running this thing as well.
It kept us very quiet too.
Well, you know, you're taking up all your time.
Yes.
But we're at a point where we've got some really cool things and thought it was important for you all to get a chance to meet everybody and see where we're at and what we're doing.
It's an exciting concept. I really like the concept. And going before the planning commission will be just green light, right?
This is my optimism. Well, we've already completed planning commission. We did that on the 11th, and they approved it unanimously.
Let me ask a question, because you're talking about parking for the park. So if I'm living in one single family homes off of, I guess it's Bennett.
Yes.
Then I could walk to the park. But, you know, if you, let's say you live off of Cameron Road and you wanted to come and didn't want to walk, how would you access the park? You'd have to come down St. John's, go down the service road and then make a right into the complex to get into the parking. Cause it doesn't seem like there's parking on the far east side, on the east side of the park.
Right.
The street there.
So everyone's going to park in the multifamily property for the park.
Yeah, and that's still kind of evolving in terms of how that all, like, works. But, yeah, the intent is that we'll have spots fronting the park for families who are coming to utilize the park.
Mm-hmm.
So under this framework plan, that's right, you'd probably take access off of St. John's or Blackson to access spots right along the walking trails mm-hmm. in the park.
There's also that entrance, I believe that's Wilkes Avenue is the one that dead ends into the current park. And so there's access right there as well.
And then we do have, I think if there's a little yellow box around it at the south end of the park, a bus stop that conveniently fronts the park and has great access to the community. So another option for accessing the park.
I think we're going to improve that a little bit, aren't we? Going to make that a little bit bigger hub there for shelter and pick up and drop off.
But if somebody likes it, but like the academy nearby says, yeah, let's have a employee thing that's close by. Let's all 100 of us go to the park. That takes out the parking lot.
So they'll max out those spots, and there is surface parking along Blacks, or there's street parking along Blackson, Bennett, Wilkes. Yeah, so it would overwhelm the spots that we have dedicated. But
so does this continue to be city owned land, or
no? It'll be owned by the Housing Authority, but yeah. At the end of 99 years, it'll revert back to the city at the end of the ground lease.
So this is being done through the PFC.
We're going to use the PFC structure because it was the easiest way for the city to know that another governmental entity can protect the requirements and the affordability and long term future, and that it takes a little bit of the risk away of it getting sold, you know something bad happening to it, that we're a good steward of the property and the land, and at the end of the 99 years. Then the city will come back in and we'll all meet here and have a big cake and celebrate when we give it back to the
99 years. I look forward to it.
In the interest of time, let me just say this. This is a good first cut. Obviously, you all will get all the community's input and incorporated and everything. My comments are not criticisms, but just sort of observations, and based on having lived in this area many, many years ago and the things I saw it. But I'm glad that, the redevelopment of this area is going to occur, because that's just, quite frankly, the property is a blight, an eyesore in the neighborhood. And so anything that lifts it up will lift up the surrounding community. And so given that we will own it, I'm looking to how will that impact their property taxes? If you live in a single-family home on Bennett, with us owning it and improving the adjacent property, will we drive up their property taxes?
That's always the argument. I don't know that the argument has actually ever been proven.
Okay.
But it's always the argument.
Okay. Something to think about from the residents' perspective, if there was somebody who wanted to oppose it, because everybody talks about how expensive property taxes are in Austin. I like it. I like what you have proposed, this rendition, because obviously it's a work in progress. It'll change and it'll be improvements based on the community's input. And so mine was observation and not any direction, because I don't live in that area and I want them to basically have what they want.
I like it a lot. My only comment about it is that, I think it's too dense. I really do. I like density. I mean, I love density. I just think knowing what we know about, 65 other properties that we've got, you get above 300-400, and you really start, there's just some real intense management that I think is, and some challenges that can be difficult. And I,
as Mary pointed out earlier, neighbors don't always get along with each other.
I just think 580 is a lot. Yeah, but
it's also 19 acres, so
yeah, it's a lot.
So no home ownership, right? I thought I had heard something about home ownership from.
It's been brought up.
Okay.
It's hard to do it on that site, and actually the number of units was in the affordability that it's creating with 280 of them was one of the things that was very put our RFP a little bit over the top.
Yeah.
That many people in the neighborhood can't even come back to that neighborhood because they can't afford those homes anymore as it is
right
now. And our hope was to provide some of these lower affordable units to where they can have some opportunities to save and gradually grow so they can at one point step up, step out, and maybe jump into one of those neighborhood houses down the road. So, I think for the site and the number, for as far big it is, I think we can handle it. I think David's
going to be. How many floors are you thinking? four.
Four stories.
The larger.
So it'll have the elevator.
Four? Okay. And that's for all four of the buildings?
Everything's anticipated to be four stories. Yes, ma'am.
The commercial are one story.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good point. The commercial, right. Sorry.
Of course.
The two on the left. Those would be one story.
Two buildings.
Okay, if there's no more discussion or questions, as the staff is here and the team that's here, thank you all very much. We appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you for having us.
Very nice surprise. Thank you.
Thank you.
Getting updates and seeing how this goes.
We will do that.
As well. Thank you.
And as chair of AAHC, yes. I suggest a break.
Sure.
I'm going to exercise my privilege.
Yes, ma'am.
My chair privilege.
I was thinking about my foot print. I had 11. That was my first print.
Wow.
Oh, man. Crazy.
Oh, I know.
You guys have been sitting for a long time.
Oh, my gosh. And I'm ready to get some drinking going.
Yeah, that's just enough of the road.
That shows you all of your property.
The you can almost see Peckridge and Center Ridge.
Almost.
On Parmer, who's next to you.
Oh, yeah, you're.
That's you can only. Yeah, but you go up.
I'm going to get out.
Oh, yeah.
It's Parmer and then our
county.
Yeah, because yeah, yours is here and here.
Got all of this.
So this is a different apartment.
Oh, my God.
And they just more, it cuts off.
No, that's perfect.
So I kind of left it there.
I had one, but
that's a great one.
I saw them. They look at
it. Okay.
Don't worry. Okay. I don't usually drink this.
We're going to change it to the next thing we're going to be talking about.
What's that?
Well, I see she was like, "Want to change it to the next one?" I'm like, "Yeah, that's the next map he's going to be showing."
Well, Ron, this from the.
You didn't respond to my comment last night.
Oh, I did.
Said you're turning. Oh, did you?
Yeah, I did.
I missed it. I
said that's a terrible thing to say. And I don't know how the hell people want employment out of this process, because it's been a
when
nightmare.
Every once in a while you hear us say this was a very difficult project to get. Now you
oh my
we don't,
God.
Quite often we don't have to deal with the city at the end like we're doing, because we don't try enough.
And all the funding.
You see the little nitpicky things that the attorneys for every single group. They just nag and nitpick.
Well, and I don't know if you've seen the latest. Now they're talking about Austin Energy wanting an electrical easement off of Yale.
Oh, you're kidding.
Which is going to wipe out maybe one or two of the home ownership units.
Oh, man.
Are you
kidding? Did that just pop up?
Yes. It just popped up. It just popped up. Like, are you freaking kidding me? Oh, my God. And then that freaking Cornell right-of-way vacation that we've been dealing with.
So we've got...
For over half a year. That's why I'm like, who's going to own that? Because if you've got a right-of-way to vacate, the park space.
Yeah.
Ard's going to want some easements.
Wait till you see what they're planning to do to our building here on the widening of 35.
I just heard...
One proposal is to take our main take our front driveway away.
By whom?
By TxDOT.
TxDOT.
To widening I-35.
Yeah.
And the other option is they're going to wipe out half of 1503 and 1507 across the street.
Oh. Like, how are people going to get in here?
They want us to. They said, "Well, you guys can put your front entrance on Reagan Terrace." And I said, "It's funny you said that, because 5 years ago when we asked to make that an entrance, you told us that it would be an act of Congress to get it through, because there's no way we can ever do it." Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden it's something easy to do, isn't
it? How about that?
And I go, "By the way, you call the fire department and tell them we only have one way in and one way out."
I know.
Mm-hmm. See what they say when you want to do that. And they got
exactly.
They got quiet real quick.
You know, I text that. They screwed up this project in San Antonio rurally. Broadway. And they were supposed to fund that highway, and they got everybody out.
That's right, not too sweet.
And all of a sudden, they decided it's on the city.
This is not bad.
Well, you heard what they did to Megan Lash's deal, right? The one right down here on Woodland?
Aren't they going to tear it down?
Affordable at 60% and below. When they made the expansion of 35, they used a map that was so old, it didn't have the development in it yet. And it wipes out the entire apartment complex.
Well, that's a fairly new one.
Yes.
Brand new. Yeah.
Yeah.
2 years. We were part of it.
So is that map going to stand?
Well, Megan's like, you know, you're going to wipe out, you know, 150 units of affordable housing that's been here. They made a mistake. So they had to go, they're going back and trying to figure out a way to redesign it, and it's still up in the air.
The one that's right down here on the
front. On Woodland, then.
Woodland, yeah.
The one right there.
Yeah, yeah. That's the way I call
it. Below 60% AMI.
Ariana Grande?
It's called, I always call it Ariana Grande. Aria Grande, I think.
Oh, yeah.
It's the only way I remember is Ariana Grande.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, get Carl in here, and we're gonna head out. Okay. We're gonna head on.
Yay.
Already, it's
going to be 3:30. I know, and my stomach's giving me a terrible fit, so I'm not sure how long I can last.
What's giving you?
My stomach.
Oh.
So, I want to move this along here.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, since all the commissioners are here,
yeah, let's
just start and go.
Yeah, go.
Okay, thank
go,
you.
Because
I'm the chair, but all right. Okay.
What time is it?
It is 3:14.
We don't have
it. All right, we're moving on to item Austin Affordable Housing Corporation's item number 3.
Okay.
Mr. Kowal, are you here?
I'm here. Just walked out.
Okay, I can do the prelim.
Okay.
It's resolution 00215. And it's authorizing AAHC to facilitate the acquisition of the Heritage Woods Apartments to cause AAHC subsidiary to own the development and cause the owner to enter into acquisition and development financing for the development. And number 4, to execute any documentation is necessary to consummation of the transaction. So that's what we're asking for.
Madam Chair, I make a motion to approve item number 3, resolution number 215.
Okay. Thank you, Carl. And Mary seconds. Is there any discussion?
Well, hold on, y'all.
That's what we're doing right next.
I'll tell you one thing I like about this is that, one, this is in the area of the area of opportunity called the Silicon Hill.
North Lamar is now Silicon Hill.
I like it.
Really?
So, yeah.
Ron, we're doing this without you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Tara had a question or a comment.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, my first question was, did we approve the minutes before this one?
Yes, we did.
Must have
and we asked for public
comment.
Citizen comment.
Okay.
Citizen comment.
Oh, very good. Okay. Well, did I have any comments? I did, and now I've lost it. Okay. The rents currently begin at $1,635 for a one-bedroom and $2,398 for two bedrooms.
That's correct.
Which is 60, 70, what percent of
AMI? Those rents now, as they sit for one bedroom, probably 110.
Yeah, this is market rate.
The market rate.
Okay,
we'll be discounting on average between $300 and $500 a unit to get it to existing at 68, and 10% of the units at 60%, and then the 40% at 80 will be $300 a unit deduction. One thing about Larry Peel, developer, and I'll explain to you is that while there's only 2 floor ones, I didn't list them all. There's 7 variations of the one bedroom. There's 9 variations of the two bedrooms.
Well, I'm seeing the square footage is quite
really vary. So there's a lot of the largest of the two bedrooms are extreme. They're 1,700 square feet.
Yeah.
It's how he used to, that's his tradition. He used to build that way.
Mm.
He wasn't a big three-bedroom guy. He never wanted to put a little square box. I've known him. I knew him for a while before he passed away. And he always rather have a spacious two-bedroom, and he always felt that, you know. There were other developments for three-bedroom properties that he just didn't believe in. But anyway, well, this is the last one of his properties.
If I can,
and it's new. I mean, it just was built last year.
If I can interject just for a second, the 1600 is actually kind of below market because most one-bedrooms, and I'm speaking from the experience with a family member who just signed a new lease, are at 1850 and above.
Well, the AMIs that we'll be renting to at 60% for one-bedroom will be $1,242 a month, and for a family of two with two incomes, it'll be $1,489 a month. Okay. That's at 60. And at 80, it is $1,656.
Now, are we trying to get 10% at 60?
Yes.
That's a definite.
That's for sure.
But if it's already 98% occupied, that's going to take a while.
Well, currently 52% of the units qualified. So what happened was this property was right at that cusp of the AMIs adjusted, 12.5%.
Right.
So some of those leases that were signed haven't been, you know,
adjusted.
So a lot of people fell into that 80% category when we did our lease audit.
Uh-huh.
So we actually are at our minimum. So now it's just going to be a managing of getting units down to the 10% at the 60 and maintaining all the units at 80. We have no interest in raising, you know, jacking people out that are already qualified under the affordable program.
Well, that's what I was hoping.
And that's the neat thing about Bell Run, that I love working with them. They're not, you know, at 50%, 51% you stop, and I don't want to see it. I mean, they're if we go to 60, we'll go to 60, and they're very, very, very amicable about that.
So. Good. Yeah, they seem to be pretty good people to work with.
It's development with them. And they've been really, really, they're here actually this, we were walking this yesterday and looking at a couple other ones, but I think what they're trying to focus on is targeting, again, these newer properties that have, if they're barely at the cusp of affordability now, we know down the road a lot of market developers going to come in, for-profit's going to come in and raise these down the road.
Right.
And so, this is a property, the asset is so nice that this market continues to trend. And I'll be honest, right now we're in a little flux because of the way the economy is going right now. It's this time of year. We're not seeing, with interest rates ticking up, you're not seeing this robust sales of these apartments for astronomical prices. And so people are raising rents $500 a month to make up for it. So we're at a good point.
Yeah.
Because it's giving us opportunities to buy things without a lot of.
But how did this come on the market after just 1 year?
Larry Peel passed away.
Yeah.
And his wife is selling all his stuff.
Oh. Okay.
And this was the last building that he built.
Mm-hmm.
She's just cashing out, you know, getting out of the real estate business. And without, he was the support and the focal point behind it. He's been in Austin. He's been in Austin in a very, very, very well-known person in Austin for 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
Building.
Mm-hmm.
You're familiar with Stillhouse condominiums on Spicewood when you go down the hill. He built those two on the opposite sides into the canyons. He was one of the first builders to ever go and be allowed to navigate through those big ravines and rocks units inside those things. It's amazing.
Yeah.
When I was first learning real estate, I got to watch him build those. And I eventually ended up living there.
Mm-hmm. Don't be impolite. We're going to lose people soon.
And you're going to lose me soon, too.
So
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Any more questions?
No more questions. I move approval.
Okay. Resolution 00215. Tyra made the motion. Carl second. Any more discussion? Thank you all very much.
We can adjourn the.
We have to vote. Did we vote?
No.
That's fine.
Right. Got to vote first.
So we Carl made the first motion and Mary seconded it, and now you did it again.
No,
we never voted.
So we're voting on the first motion.
Forget. I withdraw my
motion. So that is on resolution 00215, correct?
00215. Yes.
Okay. Well, there's no more business to come before Austin Affordable Housing Corporation. So
no. We still have to vote.
Oh.
Yeah, we have to vote.
We already voted. Okay.
No, no, no.
So all in favor of 215?
All in favor of resolution 00215.
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ron and Suzanne.
Thank you, Ron and Suzanne.
So moved. Madam Carl Chair, Brown. I move that we adjourn the Altoona Affordable Housing Corporation.
At 3:22, Mary second. Discussion? None? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
Okay. We'll go back to Southwest.
Thank you all very much.
We'll go back to Southwest Housing Compliance Corporation. We just need to move to adjourn that meeting.
So moved.
What?
Mr. Carrington moves to adjourn.
Second.
Mr. Ritchie seconds. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Southwest Housing is adjourned at 3:23.
Okay.
We'll go back to the regular board meeting of the Housing Authority of the City of Austin. We're going to take up item number 4, which is approval of the Pathways Asset Management property budgets for calendar year 2023. As you know, we do a lot of our budgeting in March. It's a calendar year nature of our RAD properties. We're bringing these to you now. You've seen pieces of these. There's lots that is very similar year over year. But we're going to give a quick, very quick overview.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. You have before you today the budget for calendar year 2023 for all 15 properties in our PAMI portfolio, asset management. The highlight really to note is in terms of revenue increase, we're looking at 2.6% revenue increase, but expense increase, we're looking at 8.1% revenue increase, or expense increase this year. And we recognize that that is a challenging combination and one that we are working to very hard to manage. Having said that, we still have over $200,000 cash flow when you look at the portfolio as a whole, and the majority, almost all of our properties except to meet the debt service ratio coverage of the lender's expectations. The two that don't, we have the expectation that because of very low turnover ratio that with 3.5% required budgeting for vacancy that they will not hit that, that will allow us to still meet that debt service ratio for the lender. So those are really kind of the big highlights and the big challenges we're facing with this budget.
So we're just navigating the inflation that we're seeing. HUD is trying to make up some of the gaps as we go along as best they can, but it'll never be enough. And then we're just hitting other issues around insurance, security, utilities, a variety of other factors that every apartment operator in town is struggling with as well. And given the limited ability to sort of raise rents and do things, and we don't want to do that, we're struggling with that. But we continue to ongoingly navigate that space. Based on that, unless Sylvia has anything you want to chime in real fast?
No, I think Michael has covered it, and we are, crossing our fingers that the operating cost adjustment factor will be much, much more robust this year, but it won't kick in until late 2023 anyway, so we won't really see the benefits of it for this calendar year. But, Michael, I just want to also acknowledge he's done a phenomenal job in putting these together and has worked very, very closely with the PAMI team.
I'll second that.
Yeah.
Incredible work putting these numbers together. We have the privilege of vetting through these just for this presentation. Incredible job he's done.
And we apologize for giving you guys such short shrift.
Yeah.
Because this is an important element also. So we apologize, but
yes,
we've been here a while.
We would ask for approval of resolution number 2767, the property budgets for calendar year 2023. 2767.
Oh, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm
looking at it. Commissioner Apicello moves to approve. Commissioner Ritchie seconded. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. And the ayes have it, and the property budgets are approved. It would probably be worth, Michael, at some time in the new year, the pandemic retreat, maybe we can come together for a program budget, a program meeting or a budget meeting, and we can have a fuller discussion about property budgets and just, because I think it is good for you to know how money is being spent.
Absolutely. And by then we'll have a sense of HUD.
Exactly.
We're buying next year.
Yep. I would also make note that Michael yesterday led a team that helped secure a
94
94 feet.
At Coronado Hills, that's one of our inspections that we had.
Out of 100, so yes.
Oh, They're not coming back for 3 years. That's our goal. Moving on to item number five, which is resolution number 2768, approval of the adoption of the revised Housing Choice Voucher Program payment standards. This is a fairly straight one as well. Lisa's going to give the highlight the top three things, but the fact is the rent is up. We need, in order for people to have to be able to lease their units, we need to be able to raise the property. We need to be able to raise the payment standards to meet the rent that landlords are expecting. Otherwise, we'll continue to see lower utilization of our vouchers, and so that's what's being recommended here. Lisa, top two or three highlights?
I think you summarized it well. I'm asking for approval of resolution number 2768.
So moved.
Okay.
Mr. Ritchie moves to approve. Commissioner Duncan Hall. No, sorry. Actually, we need Commissioner Duncan Hall moved to approve. Who would like to second other than Commissioner second. Ritchie? Commissioner Carrington. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? The payment standards are approved. Thank you, Lisa.
You're so lucky.
Item number six.
I have my questions.
Yeah, we were going to grill you.
This is 2769, asking the Housing Authority to take action with respect to the development of Heritage Woods Apartments, to acquire the site of the development, to lease the development site to the owner of the development, and any other such actions as necessary to carry out the intent to acquire and take ownership of this property.
So
Commissioner Carrington moves to approve. Commissioner Apostolo seconds. Is there any discussion?
Aye.
All in favor say aye. All opposed? And we now are going to proceed to close on what will be the bridge at Heritage Woods, which we're very excited about. Moving on to item number seven. Last item for today, which is resolution number 2770, awarding a renewal contract for the agency-wide grounds maintenance services contract. This is a contract that we have had year in and year out with our friends at Unity. They've done a fine job. They're getting a very modest increase given inflation and other factors that they're seeing. We would ask that they be awarded this contract.
Move approval.
Commissioner Duncan Hall moves.
Second.
Commissioner Apostolo second. Is there any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The ayes have it.
And I was very pleased to read their qualifications because I knew nothing about this company before. I know that now. I didn't realize it. Maybe that was it. I didn't realize it.
In the president's report, which and others can chime into my report, a couple of things happening soon. Obviously, we're looking at Thanksgiving turkey drives, and most of that is going to be done by way of gift cards to people. So less opportunity to go and haul meals to folks, but giving people an opportunity to go make selections of their own at HEB with HEB gift cards largely. And we'll, if there is an opportunity to deliver turkeys or to deliver food this holiday season, we'll certainly let you all know. I know that's been something that's been awarded to folks, but right now it doesn't look like that's in the offing. But the good news is that Austin Apartment Association has committed to contributing meals, the value of meals, up to 800 people, I think, so 800 families. So we're excited about that. They've been, you know, wonderful partners. Within Lisa's program, I'll give you the heads up that we are actively working on preparing and getting ready to release another RFP for project-based vouchers. We're looking at up to 200 housing choice vouchers and up to 100 VASH vouchers, again, to serve folks living in housing first, supportive housing environments, and Lisa's vouchers are essential to the success of those properties. And so we're looking at moving forward with those.
Can I ask a fast question? Of course. The number that has been bandied around for at least 2 or 3 years is 3,000 homeless people in this area. That seems so terribly low to me. Is that anywhere near correct, or do we know? I mean, I guess the number is coming from that call.
They do a point in time count in January. So it's never, it's whoever they count on that given time. So it's never quite accurate completely.
But we think it's probably low, don't we?
We think it's low. We think it's substantially higher than that. And but you know, it's probably worth at some point inviting Echo to come and give you all a briefing on how they see homelessness in the city, and give you the benefit of their expertise. But we're glad. So just a heads up that we'll probably be taking out that RFP probably between now and Thanksgiving. We need to get it out. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes.
And we
have a very good chance of getting them.
Oh, we already have them. We're going to transfer them from our tenant-based program, and we will assign those over to our project-based.
Yeah, and we've already received. So what we're required to do is send something to HUD to ask approval from project-based, and we've already got approval from them for the amount that was just.
Okay.
We're well below our percentage that we're able to.
Oh, great.
Okay. I would ask my colleague, Ms. Blanco, if she has anything you wish to share with the board.
Are you sure? Well, sorry. For the last, seems like, year, been obviously working closer and closer to a closing date on Rosewood Courts. It's definitely been a lot of moving parts. A lot of moving parts. And right now, we have, we'll be rate locking on Tuesday next week with an anticipated closing date of November 8th.
Excellent.
So,
election day, huh?
Y'all pray. Please pray.
We'll pray.
It's definitely been challenging. It's with working through city legal. I know we have at least one lawyer in the room, so I won't. Oh my goodness. So it's been very challenging, and then also working with HUD and getting, you know, one final thing across the finish line, and just the easements, the liens, all the legal documents. So I have a newfound appreciation for what Ron and Suzanne deal with. November 8th cannot come soon enough.
Construction to start soon after?
Yes.
Yes. The property is completely vacant, so they can start November 9th, as far as I'm concerned.
No. Permits and heat.
That's awesome. All permits there?
No.
We do not have permits in hand. That's been the challenge.
Just for the demolition?
Yeah, I think we can demo.
Can we?
Lots of work still to happen on Rosewood, but we'll keep you updated on the progress there.
Absolutely.
And we are looking to schedule some kind of a groundbreaking for there before the end of the year.
Before the ground freezes.
He's going to show up.
He already has. It's video. There's a videotape online that's touring of the chain link fenced in Rosewood.
I have not seen that.
No, yeah, go check it out. But it's, yeah, with a "this should never have happened" kind of thing. And then he highlights Muni.
He called out this guy, Palma Overton. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him. The Overton family is a very well-known African-American family in Austin dating back many, many generations. And the grandfather of the young man who calls out is one of the oldest World War II veterans, or World War I veterans, because when he passed away, he was like 107. So he was kind of a Austin icon. People used to come because his whole deal was drink a shot of bourbon every day and smoke cigars. And so people would just go and bring him, you know, high-end cigars and stuff and pay homage to him because he had, you know, served this country, and he was one of the oldest Americans alive and doing, you know. Mm-hmm. So anyway, his grandson, you know, Fred, called out because his grandson is involved with trying to preserve Lyons Municipal Golf Course, which is over in West Austin. It's in the property UT is now, so you want to redevelop that property. And so his family, you know, grew up playing on this golf course. And so he said, rather than being involved, Fred McGee calls him out and says, rather than being involved at that, the golf course, you ought to be involved in kind of on Rosewood. And so, because I got a call about it, and I just said, you know, you don't need to respond to the conversation.
We're going to be working.
Trail, when you walk out of the Y and go across Cesar Chavez, is named after one of the Overtons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The home where Richard Overton lived in is named after him, too. Richard Overton.
It's right behind Rosewood. That's just one.
Yeah, it's just right behind
you. Go at the back. If you go down to Keto.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you're past ground. So, obviously, we're working aggressively to wrap that up and to cause as little pain to the community as we can. But we want to demo whatever we can as quickly as we can and get new things up so that the community can start to see the excitement. And we feel good. You know, we're preserving 8 buildings. So we feel like we have a great preservation record. And as the person from the historic preservation office, one of the historic preservation offices said, we never thought we'd get something like this. We never thought we'd get.
Yeah, this is an unheard of.
Mm-hmm. So
many buildings. So very.
What else you got to share?
What am I missing?
Come on.
No, I'm just,
are you going to have a baby?
Oh my God.
last thing is September. Our next board meeting is scheduled for the 17th of November.
Yeah.
If folks wanted to, we could move the board meeting date to do one last board meeting this year. So instead of doing 17th, we could look, if we wanted to look at a date like December 7th, which is a Wednesday, we would be after our December 5th when we have to bring our public comment back. We could, does that screw you up?
It might. I'll check. I think we have some pretty critical things. I'll see what we need, when we need approvals to present in order to get approval.
So we'll stick with the schedule as we currently have it. But if we were to go down to just one remaining board meeting, and we could do it on December 7th, which is a Wednesday, and couple that with a staff holiday event, would folks wish to do that?
Well, what kind of holiday event?
I don't know. We'll figure that part out. But maybe a breakfast. I mean, where we still at the market.
Like we usually do.
I don't think we can get everybody in the same space.
Yeah.
But
we don't have that space.
But we might be able to get a tent, or we might be able to get – we might figure something else out.
I have to ask a question. Will the staff be getting their annual Christmas post?
If we'd like to propose that, we can do that too.
Do we have to do it now?
If we were going to just have one more meeting, if I could.
I'll be moved it.
Right now we have two. I'm proposing that we could possibly squeeze down to one if everybody's free on December 7th. Are you free on December 7th? Because your character is free on December 7th, are you free, Mary and Commissioner? So I'm checking. I put in a note to Commissioner Bailey to see if he's free on Wednesday, December 7th.
And
I've got to get Ron to check and make sure that we don't, and check with the E-team.
Prior to that.
But if we can, we'll just go down to one last remaining meeting for the year, and we'll be done. Which would be.
That'll come later.
Over the 5th.
Yeah, it's over the 5th.
We don't have it yet.
So we should be good.
We won't get awarded that until February.
Right.
Yeah.
We got. Okay.
You can't do the 14th. You want to do the
7th? We can't do the 14th. We'll,
okay,
we'll,
that's
we'll
cool.
Board members after the 7th.
Okay, that's fine.
We will.
So hold all three of those dates, the two remaining board meeting dates and the 7th. But let's if we can't get down to one, we'll try. Is there an agreement? Last thing I've got since Commissioner Alfasola raised the question, I think it would be our recommendation to go ahead and proceed with another bonus to staff. I don't know that I have a specific amount to recommend to y'all. Historically, we've done $1,000 where we pay the taxes. I think that's probably a good place to start.
We did last time?
Yes, ma'am.
And the total was what? I can't remember.
300.
Three or 400,000?
Yeah.
About 325,000, 330,000 when we factored in us paying the taxes.
Okay.
But we've had a great year.
Okay, we pay taxes.
We pay their taxes. Yep.
It's net.
You need a motion.
No, not really, it's within his authority.
His administrator.
Oh,
sure.
Yeah. Okay.
But I would do it.
Our executive can make that decision.
$1,000? Without paying the taxes?
Say up to $1,000.
Up to $1,000 without paying the taxes.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Okay. I think that's all we've got, ma'am. Mr. Chair.
I'll intend a motion to adjourn.
Second. Third.
Mr. Chairman made the motion. Commissioner Solo made the second.
All in favor, signify by saying
aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. We adjourned at 3:43 p.m. on Thursday, October 20th. Thank you all.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.